Everyone, welcome to the City of Arroyo Grande. This is our City Council meeting, and it is Tuesday, August the 12th. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Barnage?
Here.
Councilmember Brown?
Here.
Councilmember Costello?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Here.
Mayor Ferrara?
Here. Item 3 is our flag salute. We're very pleased to have Mary Schultz here from the Exchange Club of the Central Coast. Mary? Mary's going to lead us in the flag salute today. If you would, please remain standing for our invocation. Gunther Mayor Harnish is here from Baha'i Faith to do that for us.
Please join with me in the renewal of the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
O God, make this assemblage radiant. Make the hearts merciful. Confer the bounties of the Holy Spirit. Endow them with a power from heaven. Bless them with heavenly minds. Increase their sincerity, so with all humility they may turn to thy kingdom and be occupied with service to mankind. O kind Father, confer thy blessings. Consider not our shortcomings, and shelter us under thy protection. Thou art the powerful. Thou art the giver. Thou art the beneficent.
Okay, Mary, don't sit down. You haven't been here in a while.
No, I haven't.
Okay, so we get to hear about the Exchange Club. So
okay.
Anything newsy?
Well, I've been an Exchange Club member for the last 8 years, and what we do is we focus on child abuse prevention, and we do several fundraisers throughout the year, and we have scholarship money that we give to at-risk kids in Lopez, Arroyo Grande, and Napomo High School. And they write an essay, and then it's judged by several counselors and teachers, and then the ACE Award is given to two deserving young people. And they use that money for their college experiences. So let's see what else we do. We're ambassadors at the Strawberry Festival, so we get to wear those very attractive green vests. And then we go around and help all the vendors. And we also give out a flag at the Grover Beach Parade, and we always walk alongside Cacho Asagian. So that's about it.
All right. Well, we appreciate the good work that you do, and thanks. Hope you come back and do our flag salute for us again. Okay, moving along to item 5, agenda review. Item 5A is closed session announcements. The council did meet in closed session on Tuesday, July the 8th. The council took no reportable action at that or during that session. Item 5B, move that all ordinances presented for introduction or adoption be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved. Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Moving on to item 6, special presentations. We have none this evening. Item 7 is community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for members of the public to come forward and offer any suggestions, recommendations, comments that they would like to share. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking any action on matters that are not posted on the agenda. We would ask that you keep your comments to 3 minutes or less. And please reserve your comments for items that are not on this evening's agenda. Anyone who would like to come forward during community comments and suggestions, please do so.
Good evening, council members. My name is Dale Hansen. I come before you because I'm concerned
with what I've seen over the last 13 years. I'm very much involved in ethics standards, code of conduct, such things as that. I called the staff today and asked them if you had a code of conduct or ethical standards. Basically, what I wanted to know is the use of the title of city council member outside of city business. They said there was none. They furthermore kind of shared with me that they believe, or at least someone believes, that may be forbidden by state law to make any restrictions on that. What I find ironic is under federal law, retired military personnel, retired civil servants cannot use their former rank or position for anything dealing with commercial or to support anyone politically in campaigns. I would ask the council to consider developing some type of policy, because when the title is used outside of the city business, it's perceived by people as city business approved. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Anyone else who would like to come forward? Once again, items not on this evening's agenda.
Good evening, council members. I am Lucas Castellino. I've been working on my Eagle project, and I just recently finished it. My Eagle project was the flag drop box here in Arroyo Grande at the American Legion Post 136, which is located at 417 Orchard Street. This flag drop box is open anytime to the public. It is there for the public to have a place to put their own flags that need to be retired or that are faded or tattered, is what it means to be retired. That's what it means when it needs to be retired. And so it's there for the public so they can have a place to put it. And on every June 14th on Flag Day, the American Legion respectfully retires the flags with a ceremony. Any questions?
No, thank you. Okay, thank you for your comments, and thanks for the Eagle Project. I'm sure we'll make good use of it, so appreciate you being here tonight. Okay. Anyone else who would like to come forward? Once again, items not on the agenda this evening. Last call. Okay. We'll close community comments and suggestions, and we will move on to item 8. This is our consent agenda. If you're following along this evening, we're going to be addressing consent items 8A through 8O. We have a lot of them this evening. This is also an opportunity for members of the public to come forward and comment on any of the items that are on the consent agenda. This is normally a group of items that the council approves in one motion, unless there is a item on the consent agenda that a member of the council would like to pull for further clarification, discussion, or an independent action. So once again, I would like to invite anyone who would like to come forward and comment on any of the consent items, 8A through 8O, on your agenda. This would be your opportunity. Anyone? Okay, seeing no one, we will close public comment on the consent agenda. We'll bring this to the council. What is the will of the council this evening? Anything to pull?
I'd like to pull 8K, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. 8K. Any others? 8K. Okay. All right. I'll entertain a motion to approve consent items 8A through 8O, with the exception of 8K and 8J.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Anything to read in there, David? No? Okay. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. All right. We'll go back to 8K. Councilmember Barnidge.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just have a couple questions on this. I guess, Steve, I talked to you a little bit about, does this sound loud enough? The mic? Yeah, sounds okay? Okay. I talked to you on the phone. I think I wasn't, obviously when these restrictions went into place, I wasn't on the council, and I don't think we looked at it on Planning Commission. But my understanding is that the trucks used to be parked on El Camino Real, and then the motel owner that didn't like them parked there. So then they were moved sort of into the neighborhood, and now because of complaints from the neighborhood, which I totally understand, they're being moved back to El Camino Real, and that's because the hotel owner has sort of changed. It's a new owner, correct? Okay. Are they staying at the hotel when they park there, or are they just parking there?
Usually they're staying at the hotel. Okay. I mean, we don't really monitor that, but according to the hotel owner, it's important to have some space for his for the folks staying there, so that's their primary incentive. Now, we have all along had some parking spots on the other side of El Camino Real, but the issue was right in front of the hotel, and that's what's changed. So what's being proposed is eliminating it behind the hotel and moving it and allowing it in front of the hotel, which the new hotel owner is supportive of.
Okay. All right. And do we think there's enough room where we're having them move?
Yeah, it's at least as many spaces as on the other side of the hotel, and probably more because you don't have the driveways there. So I think it's probably an increase in space.
Okay. Those are all my questions. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Any other comments on 8K? If not, would you care to make a motion?
I move for approval of item 8K.
Okay. We have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
All right. A motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. All right. 8J, Councilmember Brown.
Steve, I want to ask about Omni Means and how was the contract arrived at in terms of, was it put out to bid? Just describe that whole process for me, if you would.
I'll allow the Community Development Director to answer that.
We've had an ongoing contract with Omni Means for several years. Extension is an extension of time that will get us through the next 8 to 9 months. And then would put this consulting contract on the same timeline for RFP as our other engineering services contracts. So we have had on Omni Means, it was competitively, they were competitively selected, but it was a number of years ago, and we've been renewing that contract for on-call services specific to traffic and circulation needs. And it is the intent this evening to continue with them because we're right in the middle of several studies, and this will allow us to complete those studies and then go out for RFP for traffic and circulation at the same time as our other engineering service contracts.
Great. Thank you. Those are my questions, Mr. Mayor. I move for approval.
All right. We have a motion to approve 8J. Is there a second?
Second.
And a second. Discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Okay, moving on to item 9, public hearings. We have none this evening. Item 10 is continued business. 10A is continued consideration of a pre-application number 14-004, general plan amendment, specific plan amendment. This is for the property proposed project at Grand Avenue and Cortland. And before we go any farther with this particular item, as I have indicated before when this item has come forward, it's going to be necessary for me to step down from the dais. The Fair Political Practices Commission restricts any member of the council from participating in the decision-making process on issues affecting property that is within a 500-foot radius of their primary residence, and mine is well within that 500-foot radius. So I'm going to have to step down. I'll turn this item over to the Mayor Pro Tem, and I will see you in a few moments.
that I will turn it over to staff for the opening presentation.
Thank you, Mayor Pro Tem, members of the council. Tonight you'll be reviewing revisions to a conceptual development plan at the southwest corner of East Grand Avenue and South Cortland Street. The council previously considered and provided comments on this project on July 8th of this year, and the applicant has made revisions to the concept plan and in response to those comments. Tonight, the applicant's seeking additional comments on the conceptual development before proceeding with a formal entitlement application. The subject property is zoned gateway mixed use, and it's the final piece of the Berry Garden specific plan. Surrounding land uses include various commercial developments, as well as the People Self-Help Housing Project to the south, Berry Gardens further south, as well as the city limits to the west. For reference purposes, here's the previous concept site layout. It included 10 to 12,000 square feet of commercial development, which is adjacent to East Grand Avenue. And it also included 42 single-family homes on the southern portion of the site, which would be accessed from South Cortland Street. Now, in response to council comments on July 8th, the applicant has revised the conceptual development portion of the project, commercial development portion of the project. It will maintain 10 to 12,000 square feet of commercial floor area. However, the applicant has included 4 second-story dwelling units above the commercial development for vertical mixed use. Additionally, in order to accommodate an additional row of parking on the southwest portion of the commercial site, the applicant has removed one of the single-family homes, which is in the northwest corner of the residential portion of the site. These next two images, again, are from the original concept elevations for the commercial portion of the project. Here's a view of the commercial development from East Grand Avenue and Cortland Street intersection. As well, again, the initial concept. This is from the center driveway from East Grand Avenue into the commercial development. This slide shows the revised contemporary commercial style, which I do believe that the applicant has further refinements that they will present during their portion. The applicants are utilizing additional massing along with more contemporary modern architecture styles, such as smooth building lines and forms for, again, a more modern commercial development, along with the uniform two-story construction with the vertical mixed-use portion of the project. The applicants are showing to retain the middle driveway. Staff has mentioned several times that we would like to see that removed due to the pedestrian vehicular conflict that can arise from driveways, but it is proposed to remain at this point. Staff thinks that if it does get removed, it will provide additional opportunity for pedestrian-oriented features, public art, as well as, again, reduce that pedestrian-vehicle conflict. Here's an image of the neighborhood green with the contemporary agrarian residential style of architecture from the initial concept. Here's an additional elevation of the contemporary agrarian as viewed from South Cortland heading down Cortland toward Berry Gardens. And here's the revised concept project. The architectural style has been updated to mid-century modern. And these units specifically are being viewed standing in the middle of the neighborhood green, looking toward the interior units. So the applicants have indicated that they're attempting to distinguish the development from the remainder of Berry Gardens by switching to the more mid-century modern architectural style. And that was also in response to council member comments. One of the items that has remained unchanged from the previous concept was the twist on the zero lot line interior parcels. Typically, zero lot line, the residences are constructed right on the property line. In this instance, property lines would be established evenly between the units, However, their use would be the area of use would be restricted to only one of the units rather than two. This does allow for design modifications and additional design features that wouldn't be allowed if the homes were right on the property line. A specific plan is required to implement and be consistent with the general plan. Although the applicants have made significant modifications to address general plan policies, staff still believes that a formal application that comes forward, if it's similar to the project being proposed, should also include a general plan amendment to address remaining inconsistencies. That being said, staff has not investigated what form of general plan that would end up taking, whether it would be adding additional policies, modifying existing policies, or even deleting existing policies. Then that would all come out upon formal application. Staff wanted to highlight some additional points regarding the project. One of these is ensuring that adequate steps are being taken to include features that address the existing design guidelines for the mixed-use district, as well as being within the spirit of the enhancement plan, which again was formally routed into the public and through the council, but never formally adopted, so it acts as just kind of a guidance policy document. With regard to the upcoming East Grand Avenue Enhancement Plan, staff has completed an administrative draft of the RFP and anticipates it to be released to the public in the next few weeks. Staff has encouraged the property owner to withhold a formal application until we have time to develop the East Grand Avenue Plan. However, the property owner has set his own deadline, being the end of the calendar year, and that's too aggressive for staff's timeline on the East Grand Avenue Plan. Additionally, the residential parking will be something to further investigate due to on-street parking not being an option on South Cortland Street. Staff thinks that there's opportunities to include additional guest parking on the interior of the residential site, as well as investigating further the parking reduction between the uses. With regard to an environmental review, again, environmental review is not required for the pre-application. However, any formal project would require environmental review under CEQA. Additionally, no public hearing is required for tonight's meeting. However, the agenda and staff report were both available to the public on Friday, August 8th, and staff has not received any comments from the public. And that concludes staff's presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
I think my biggest concern has to do with the general plan amendment, and you've already talked about the fact that you really don't know the nature that's going to take, but to me that's the largest kind of elephant in the room we got to deal with. Staff's been pretty clear with me that, and I happen to agree, that it's in conflict with a lot of the general plan policies, but we're also left with one of the few pieces left to develop, and the applicant's been through multiple reiterations of what that project might look like. I guess my biggest concern is, and have you thought about crafting a general plan amendment that would limit the changes from the general plan we currently have now? In other words, would we be opening the door for other projects coming down the pike, or would we be crafting it in such a way that, because that's a huge issue for me.
Certainly, staff's brought this up because of the required findings that would have to be made should a formal application come forward. Those findings do include a consistency with the general plan, and we have pointed out some potential conflicts. So the decision then would have to be that you find that consistent with these policies, that the project coming forward would be consistent, or you're faced with a general plan amendment to modify those policies. As to your question regarding how could that be done to limit the precedent that this project would create, it probably could be done. Indeed, there is a policy here that speaks specifically to this location, That is LU5-10.1, and that's promoting the development of high-intensity mixed-use pedestrian activity nodes centered on the Cortland Street and East Grand Avenue intersection. As a priority example of revitalization of this corridor segment known as a gateway. My concern in answering your question is this policy speaks to whatever project happening on this project on this property should be the catalyst project, should be the project that we would want to see mimicked up and down the corridor with redevelopment over time. And you know, the modification would be to say we want all these things up and down Grand Avenue, perhaps except on this location. It is a bit of a conundrum, a very attractive project, but the detached single-family housing type does seem to be the crux of the conflict with these general plan policies.
Thank you. And then just in terms of water use, I think we're all, you know, acutely aware of where we're at with water, and we're getting towards, you know, semblance of build-out. And so I guess my question is, has there been any calculation about what kind of stress this project's going to put on our water supply and, if, you know, what the typical water use might be?
The calculations would come with the environmental studies that would be required of the project. The land use anticipated for the site was included in the general plan build-out calculations. I would anticipate that this project would be very close to those numbers, but perhaps higher due to the residential, proportion of the project being residential.
That's the crux to my question. I don't think when we did the general plan, you know, that we anticipated that type of use on that property. So, and I know there's council people that will disagree with my opinion, but it would seem to me that until we know what the commercial use is, it's most likely that the residential use is actually going to be more water intensive, even without yards and even without, you know, the typical amendments for, or, you know, I'm trying to think.
Conservation measures implemented.
So, That's my concern, and it's not that it's a deal breaker. I just think that as we go forward, we have to be cognizant of, and we need to calculate and understand, you know, where our water use is at, so that these changes that we've made along the way are calculated into it. Because just to fall back on our old calculation, given where we're at now, I don't think is prudent. So,
certainly, development of the site was calculated in, but this whole portion of the site was calculated in as commercial use, which is a lower water use than residential uses. I would just note that if it was a multifamily project housing type, those types of housing use less water than your single-family detached in general.
Okay. Thank you. Those are my questions.
Yeah, I have a couple things, Jim. Yeah, I don't think so. The staff report, you talk about wanting to eliminate that second driveway. And what's staff reasoning behind that, Matt?
Multiple, actually. It's listed, again, the East Grand Avenue Enhancement Plan, which, again, is just a guidance document. It does recommend limiting specifically on this project site the driveway entrances to one. There's less vehicular pedestrian conflict opportunities from either either negligent pedestrians or negligent drivers, as well as the expanded opportunity for pedestrian paseo or you know, kind of more of a livelihood there in the center of the development.
Okay. And then also in the staff report, the emergency access that you talk about on this project going into the people's self-help housing, it's narrow. It's too narrow on this project, but it works on the people's self-help. So their emergency access is okay. It's just too narrow here on this project?
Here specifically, it's narrow between these two homes, just around that bend. Again, it's something that staff wanted to highlight and point out, but we think it can be refined in the actual, in a formal application.
Okay, but it's okay with people's self-help. It's already
correct, yes.
Being built. Or, okay, thank you. And then you and I talked about the distance between these, what's proposed on these buildings right here, trying to get an idea of density, and the Marsh Street Commons, which is another project that we've looked at in San Luis Obispo. And it's, I think it's 10 feet between these and 6 feet between Marsh Street Commons. Is that what we came up with?
That's about correct. I'm sure the applicant could probably clarify that, but from what staff has been able to gather on this project, it's about 10 feet between homes, and then on Marsh Street Commons, it's about 6.
Okay. I think all my other questions are for the applicant. Thank you.
A couple of questions, well, related to the general plan, the requirement for the general plan amendment. I guess the first one would be, when we looked at this the first time, there certainly was a disagreement over what the interpretation of the general plan was, but there was no suggestion that we would need a general plan amendment. Just, I would say that it was kind of open that it would take an interpretation. I'm wondering what's changed for staff that now we're going to, that staff now thinks we require a general plan amendment.
I would say that given the discussion that occurred at the first pre-application hearing, brought to light, some specific discussion of these policies, really staff would have to envision trying to write the findings for approval, and in that process came upon the fact that might be difficult. So, given these specific policies pointed out.
I want to go back to, and I know Matt forwarded these to me, so you're familiar with them. Going back to a couple of the last projects that we approved in this immediate vicinity, essentially on this corner under the same general plan, and looking at the first assess lot project there, which is, a commercial project that has zero residential, and I would say really minimal pedestrian. And even as far as intensity goes, it's not a particularly intense project. In fact, it's one of the comments was that it's been unoccupied for some time. I'm wondering then what were the set of findings where we were able to allow that project to move forward with really none of these elements in place?
Well, that project didn't have the any conflict with the findings of the specific plan regarding multifamily the increase in commercial and retail activity. I think that's in the economic development element, which is new since then. That project certainly was envisioned and constructed as a commercial project. And in terms of its intensity and its commercial type and its design, I feel that I would say that we're simply raising the bar in terms of design, but that didn't conflict specifically with the general plan. It didn't have the housing that's proposed here is specifically not the housing type that's mentioned in these policies. There was no housing mentioned or being proposed or evaluated in terms of these general plan findings with the CESLOC project.
Well, it's still though part of the quote high intensity node, which is this corner. Granted, it's one space away, but if you do it based on lot size, it would still be within that designation. So there was no requirement. My point is there was no requirement of high intensity or any residential, and yet we're making an assumption that we can't interpret the general plan in this particular program that way.
Well, we feel that that project proposed commercial space at 100% commercial space instead of housing.
Okay. Then looking directly across the street, and I'll just preface this by saying that I actually voted against this project at Planning Commission based on some of the same issues that staff is raising today. But ultimately, the project across the street where the bank and the small retail section are closed, was in fact passed by council with exactly these. There may not have been the economic development specifics there, although we had an economic development that called for intense development of Grand Avenue. And yet that one went forward not only with what I would call very low intensity considering the amount of square footage it was bombed, but also with the four drive-throughs. And yet we were able to come to some sort of a general plan finding that approved that, and I'm wondering what was different there that is significantly different than this project other than the timing.
Well, certainly the amount of commercial, the proportion of the commercial is greater on that project. The housing proposed with that project was special needs housing, which is specifically listed in these policies. So again, it's that special needs housing or attached housing format that wasn't in conflict with that these general plan findings and the ones that we're concerned with now.
I recognize that when you're talking about the totality of the project, we're including the senior project, but when the commercial came forward, it came forward separately.
It was actually a similar situation as this project, though. That was originally envisioned as one mixed-use project. During implementation, they were separated, and actually they were entitled separately. What was originally part of an overall project proposal when it started.
Some had seen the distinction, but
and the commercial and residential proportions were about 50-50 on that project.
Once again, the key thing that staff's struggling with is simply the definition of mixed use, which does not include single family. So it's not density is part of the part of the overall thing that the project's lacking to meet, I think objectives. But the crux of the conflict is that the mixed use does not include in it, in its definition currently, single-family homes.
So if they attached these and they didn't really increase density significantly, that would be okay, even though it only technically meets the objective, not practically.
If you have the opportunity to increase density if you attach the housing types. So you would look for increased density or increased project amenities or increased availability for commercial development. And again, it's policies in the general plan that are laid out to for the whole corridor. And I'm just going to go back to the precedent that would set perhaps the single-family detached housing types in the commercial corridor.
The last question I had, probably the one that disagrees with Councilman Brown on the water, is when we did the calculation for the general plan, we actually included significant increases in density all up and down Grand Avenue that would have had, that would require water. So there is in our general plan water available to do, all of these, but for one, this is significantly fewer units than if, for instance, if something as dense as people self-housing was developed here. The net water use, while the individual unit use might be lower, the net water use from that many units would obviously be higher, would likely be higher.
The EIR prepared for the general plan update back in 2000 probably generalized that whole area. Our recent water master plans and urban water management plans and so forth that looked at build out calculations did look at this property in terms of commercial use being the full portion of what's being considered tonight. So there would be a net increase if it goes to residential. Probably again covered in our build out calculations, but just specifically it would be a slight increase in what was anticipated.
And related to multifamily versus single family, which I know there is a difference in water use, but I remember it's certainly not 2-to-1. It's something less, but it's not that much less.
It certainly varies with the with the type of housing, and this project would certainly include measures for water conservation, fairly strict measures for water conservation. But I just wanted to point out, generally speaking, yes, multifamily housing, attached housing formats will use less water than single family formats.
As our usual policy, we'll move it over to the applicant to make their presentation and answer any questions.
Good evening, Pro Tem Mayor and council members. I'm glad to be back. We've done some work. We're excited about, I think it's moving in a good direction. I am here, Scott and I are going to be presenting this together, and we also have the developers here too, if you'd like to talk to them, the landowner, and both for the commercial and the residential. So changes that we really heard loud and clear that we wanted to make sure we incorporated to really make it true vertical mixed use and not just the commercial in the front and residential in the back. So we've been able to incorporate that along Grand Avenue, add more mass to the buildings. Before, there were some single-story buildings and more of a village kind of Western-style architecture, and you like the idea of it being a little bit more mass along Grand Avenue, still keeping the parking tucked behind. Turning the commercial, giving it a little bit more of a contemporary flair rather than the Western flair that we had before on architectural style. And then also giving the residential a more contemporary, what we're calling mid-century contemporary style of architecture. We also looked into the bus stop and eliminating that turn, and we want to talk a little bit about that and what our findings were on that. Go forward. So Matt went over the changes, the site plan. We intensified the commercial a little bit more. We expanded it to accommodate that parking. There wasn't a lot of change on the site plan. Scott, you want to talk about commercial?
Debbie, maybe you could hand these out. Didn't make it in your packet. I apologize for that. At this stage of a process, we are constantly trying to update and continue to meet staff's desires and council's desires and development desires. So we were working minutes before even. So it's exciting to see a project like this and its continued development and progression. So that's part of what we want to show you tonight. Just to touch briefly on the commercial portion, the mixed-use portion of the site plan, this is where the most significant changes have been made since last time we were here. We think we heard you loud and clear. Give me some real mixed use, and we're hoping that this is that catalytic project that staff and yourselves can point to for projects up and down Grand Avenue and say, see, they did mixed use. How come you're not? That's what we want. That's what's going to work. And so we're really excited to be here today to show you residential multifamily units in this project attached above a commercial setting. It's not very common in this town. I think it's going to be exciting. I think it's going to bring, if you look at San Luis Obispo and what one of the developers here did with March Street Commons, I know everybody came out and saw that project, that has spurred development in that area for similar project types. And we hope that this can help provide some of that same startup energy and excitement along Grand Avenue. So we're proposing four residential units above the westerly commercial building and elevating the mass of the easterly commercial building, keeping that as retail space only, but a higher elevation so that it feels consistent with the mixed-use building to the west. We have talked, you know, one of the big issues with the circulation, we think there's great pedestrian connectivity here. We think this is going to be the best example of pedestrian connectivity you have on this portion of Grand. There's plaza space on the corners. There's plaza spaces on the interior paseo. There still has to be a way to get cars in. So that's part of the struggle of any of these projects. From a visibility standpoint and a project awareness, we want to make sure we're pulling back from the corner so that you can see as a user, there's a place for cars to pull in and a place for cars to park. Heading the other direction, the center right in is very important as a way to keep visibility and access into the project. We've been in talks with RTA about eliminating the right in on the westerly portion of the project. So there was only one right in access, right in the center, right in the middle of the project, at the special paving, at the outdoor plazas, visible connection to the green space. I think that's where it wants to be. I think that's where it deserves to be. You'd never see the one, and there's a potential bus conflict at the one on westerly. So we're in discussions about making that just a right out only, just to sort of help with circulation. So I hope that walks you through that a little bit. Let me see if I can have any more luck. There you go. That shows the elevation along Grand. Again, trying to create more mass, more substance, a truly engaging project along Grand Avenue. Two-story masses right at the 35-foot height limit, really creating that threshold to the city, if you will. We think this is that example project that can create the I've entered, I'm here, I'm where I want to be. There's a couple numbers up here to show you some of the updated perspective views so you know what you're looking at. Number one and number two, the corner, and then the opposite westerly end. This is the building that would not have residential above but would have the heightened volume, so you're getting great natural light, pedestrian connectivity, enhancements along the sidewalk. There's actual pedestrian breaks into the commercial area the whole way. You can start to see some of that outdoor plaza and then that sort of modernized version of what we were showing last time. From the other end, as you're entering the city, true mixed use, residential units above ground floor retail. You can see that on the right, that's where the right out would be, but further up to really create an arrival point at that center Paseo Plaza area would be the in and out, if you will. We feel like there's good articulation, there's street mass, there's widened sidewalks, there's vegetation, pedestrian environment, inviting, articulated. We hope we're heading in the right direction. Debbie, you want to talk about density a little bit?
Yeah. One of the things I was asked is what, and when we compare this to Marsh Street Commons, what's the density comparison? And so one of the things we did is what would happen in Marsh Street Commons, we don't have any guest parking. We don't have any common area. We don't have the emergency access. So if we eliminated that, what would our density be? So the density here is, without those things, would be 14.85 units per acre. So it's starting to get up there a little bit when you do kind of apples to apples. The difference in the way we've laid this one out, this one is 8 feet between structures. Marsh Street Commons is 6 feet between structures. So we were hoping, you know, on Marsh Street Commons, it kind of does feel like an alleyway between structures. We wanted it to have a little bit more space in there. That's why the 8 feet instead of the 6 feet. We are also, so when you compare that 14 dwelling units per acre to what your code says, it does fall into the townhome medium density. It's a little more dense than your typical single family housing. So it's almost like what we're asking is to have a paradigm shift between your traditional single-family detached home, which you see in Berry Gardens, to this new product, which we don't really see it as a single-family detached home as much as this detached townhome. We see it as a different product than what you typically have. It's much smaller. It's much more dense. So that kind of walks into later, we can talk more about the general plan policies.
Debbie did a great job of touching upon that. You know, the design is constantly evolving. And if you look at this, we are right in line with what your townhome attached product would be from a density standpoint. We're just smart. We've done it well. We've gotten a way to do it and still get side yards to give outdoor space. And that I think that's something great. I think that's something your users are going to want. The workforce housing need that is in this area is going to be so proud to be able to stand up and get a single-family house and yet still be provided at a market that's more affordable, that gets you into a first-time buyer, a move-down. There is definitely some really innovative, exciting things here. Now, what that architecture looks like, we've shown you a couple options. This is the mid-century modern version. I like it. I think it's great. I think it starts to attach on some of its own unique character. I liked what we showed before. So if it's more of a contemporary agrarian, I think either can be appropriate. We're here to get feedback from you tonight. I really think the product type is something unique. And yeah, it doesn't exactly fit in the filing system that you've had in the past, but I think it still achieves the goals that the policies that are listed for this area. So we're excited about this project. I hope you are too. I think it can be a really marquee place.
So I just wanted, we haven't had a chance to talk to staff and sit down and go through the general plan consistency issues to really get a good understanding of what their concerns are and to give our ideas of how we view them. But I just wanted to point out a few key words. On the first general plan item, LU5 10.1, it talks about mixed use, pedestrian activity, and a priority example of revitalization. And I really see what we're proposing along Grand as being a really nice priority project that you would want to be carried out down Grand. And it is mixed use, and it does have really strong pedestrian connections. So when we looked at this, we saw that as being consistent. Pleasing transitions. This has been designed so that the massing is very similar to the massing on either side of it and across the street. So the transitions to surrounding developments, again, we feel like we've done a good job in those transitions. And promoting infill development, this is a great example of infill development, and it is retaining and expanding businesses. But one thing I want you to consider is it's not only do we have to provide opportunity for expanding businesses, so it's 10 to 12,000 square feet of more retail, but we also have to provide the workforce housing. And the economic studies show that this is the type of workforce housing that is really in demand right now. So it kind of accomplishes that goal in a different way. This one talks about intensifying infill. It's definitely intensifying it from what it is. And it doesn't really say how much it should intensify it. So is that really inconsistent? I'm not sure. Enhancing connectivity and increasing retail utilization. Again, we are enhancing connectivity. We are increasing the retail utilization. The general plan policy doesn't say how much. It doesn't give a measurable amount. So I don't know when does it trigger needing a general plan amendment. And the last two, multiple family and rental apartments. We are suggesting four rental apartments now. So we're starting to get closer to that general plan amendment as well. It's not your traditional multiple family. It's not attached, but it is a new form of intense specialized housing that really is in need, this workforce housing. And the last one, special needs housing in a mixed-use corridor. I know special needs housing usually looks at something else, but this is a special need right now, and I don't know if maybe that's the way we amend the general plan. I don't know. We'll have to work with staff and you to figure out what is the best way to address these policies with the general plan. So tonight, we really are here to get your feedback, see if we're moving in the right direction. We've outlined four questions that we're hoping that we can walk away with answers from you or direction from you. I know this isn't a voting type of thing, but if you can give us just directions, thumbs up, thumbs down, keep working on it, that would be really helpful.
I don't know who would be best suited, but whoever can come to the microphone, whoever can answer the questions. I have a question regarding the commercial space, maybe Nick probably, about this. The square footage of those residential units above, I guess I was sort of surprised they were so large. Have you thought about, I don't envision families living up there. I envision No. maybe a couple or a single person. So the 1,000 to 1,300 square feet, do you think we could break those up and make, I know you don't even want to do residential to begin with, so you probably don't want to do six instead of, but I just thought maybe those would be more in line to who's going to rent them.
I'm actually putting all my in-laws in there, so there's a lot of room. No, I'm kidding. I have wonderful in-laws, by the way. She might be listening. I actually kind of agree with you. They are large. There is a difference a little bit in this, in that with the mixed use, there potentially will be internal hallways. So there is some shrink that occurs in the overall footprint when you get to the second floor. Generally to me, 800, 850 feet is more of a two-bedroom type apartment. It is, yeah, to me, a one-bedroom, two-bedroom type of thing. Yeah. There's also a little bit of a trade-off that occurs in between aesthetics and functionality a little bit. When we go to the second floor and every unit requires a certain parking, number requirements, or candidly, extra bedrooms, and then trying to trade that off and how many more spaces do we need and how much more does that take out of the housing in the process, as well as how much more concern do I bring upon retail tenants. So there's a little bit of a balancing act. My suspicion is when we come back, there'll be more than four, when and if, I guess, depending on the response, when and if we come back, there probably will be more than four units, because I think those are large. Okay. And I don't think that's an environment to encourage a mom, dad, and four kids. It's just not a good, it's right. not a good fit.
Right. No, and I would agree with that, just because of the commercial downstairs and.
Right.
Okay. 1,000 maybe, but the 1,300, that was just pushing it. Okay, so maybe you'll take a look at that. Let's see what else. The second driveway. I would agree that I think this is going to be a destination shopping center, and everyone here is going to know what's going to be there before it's even built. And so I really don't think you need that second driveway. If you have the first driveway and then you can drive around the corner and come in, that's my opinion. But why are you guys kind of holding on to you want that center driveway?
I was asked that by another council person, and it was funny. It was an intuitive, immediate response, like, oh, no, you have to have that. But I didn't do a very good job of articulating why. And let me say this, because we've talked it over within the group, and the pedestrian car conflict, I would see, and not to take this in the wrong fashion, I almost would see that as a win, because that means we're bringing pedestrians to the site. We're increasing walking traffic to some extent. Not that we want to create a dangerous environment, not that we want to have anything that doesn't take advantage of some of the neat kind of layouts and designs that are currently in this thing. But I think that what my biggest concern is that there's no left in anything off of Grand, because we have the median going out there. So everything is a right in. In the Grover Beach property line, when you go out there, the building on the corner is the 7-Eleven that's there. That goes right to the property line out on the curb. So that when you're driving by, we have essentially 20 feet before they have to make the turn to get into the property. From my perspective, it doesn't. They have to be planning on going there, to make it successful, we have to have is beyond that. We have to have the impulse kind of stop. They go, oh gosh, yeah, great, let's go. And I know this sounds like people are lazy, or that's what I'm indicating. But if the other answer was, oh gosh, I missed the turn, which would happen quite a bit, then they would have to go down, turn on Cortland, turn around, and come back. And especially if they're coming to the building on the west side, it's a big, long thing. What I do think might make some sense is keeping the center and making the western thing only an out. So it's a right out only. It would not be my preference, but it certainly creates kind of less of the vehicular traffic going out there. It may encourage, you know, the traffic going the other direction. And basically where it's, you know, angle, we may lose a parking space in doing that because you'd, you know, make it so that they could only make a right out. The other thing in this is that the way it's designed, because we don't have tenants that are lined up, but I think done well, this will, and parked reasonably well, we'll be able to attract some neat tenants. But it's the outside area that the patio areas and stuff that have been designed into this that make it just kind of a neat little, from my perspective, neat environment with three patios that, for the most part, are very close in size. Actually, they may be, you know, I don't know. I should know this. I think they're either very close or slightly larger than Rooster Creek's patio. So there's three separate ones, and the way that we've designed, we've made them so they're kind of protected. We got probably the most important, most valuable one being the one on the hard corner, because that's the one that people that are sitting at the stoplight see, and the more people that are out there, the more that has a tendency to attract people in. And so, and it's also the wind-protected side. The other one is a nice amenity, depending on the tenant that is on the western side of the eastern building. But those are actually fairly large outdoor patios that are really trying to design to make this as much of an indoor-outdoor feel. You know, very candidly, we hope to include that in the rentable square feet in some of those areas so that although the building may be, you know, 12,000 feet, there's another 3,000 to 3,500 feet of occupiable area.
Okay, thank you for that. This architectural rendering is a lot better than the one in the packet, because when I looked at this contemporary, or are you calling it contemporary? I think you are. In this, on the commercial, talking about the commercial, I looked at this contemporary style, and I guess maybe it's just because of the way it's drawn. It didn't really look as modern as this looks, so I appreciate this perspective. It's a lot better. To me, this looked just a lot more common, like you'd see over at CVS, or I actually drove over there by UPS, and I thought, well, that kind of looks like the UPS store. So I know that you didn't build the Marsh Street Commons, but Andy did, and we were over there, some of us that were over there, and we looked at it, and I think I really liked that style.
So do I.
Okay, so as long as, you know, if the formal application comes back, as long as we can, I just want it to look different. I mean, I really want it to look different than the commercial, than some of the other commercial. I want it to be different. So this makes a big difference. I think it looks different. And then I had some questions on the residential units, that the density. I wanted to talk about that. I don't know who wants to come up and. Okay, so my question is the density. You know, that's what I'm a little bit hung up on because of these general plan amendments that staff is suggesting. And so, have you looked at if we made some of the project attached, or say you made all of the units attached? How much density would we really gain from that?
Well, that's tough. It's a water balloon. So, like any multifamily project, you're still trying to provide some outdoor private space and then outdoor common space. So we're actually using the space in between each unit to provide private outdoor space, which allows for engaging front porches, eyes on the street, a way to engage in that community space. If that was to go away, like many townhome projects, you might end up with something like a fence behind the back of your unit to close off and create a private yard space. So you can see it up and down in townhome projects all over. So we haven't done exact site. I mean, we've done a number of site plans, but I can't tell you that we would gain all that much more density, and in our minds, it's a much less desirable project for a buyer and for a community space. So from a density standpoint, if you reduced the center green, the community space, and looked at putting up a bunch of fences to create private outdoor space, and then just ringed it all. Anything can be done. Again, we feel like this is within that multifamily density range that the city calls for.
Well, so what I'm getting at is that you guys brought up workforce housing, and that's what I envisioned when I first saw this. But then I did, I looked at this in comparison to in the packet with the Berry Gardens, the overlay,
size-wise.
Someone had said maybe these would be $400,000 to $450,000, and I know nobody wants to go there because this could never happen. We don't know, but I don't know if workforce housing can afford something like that. So then I think, okay, well, if we took away some of the green space, even though I agree, that's a wonderful amenity, but in order to have policemen, firemen, teachers afford something like this, what do we have to do to make it a little bit more affordable? So I struggle with that. I'm still struggling with that. I just wanted to know if you had looked at attaching some of them and maybe making a portion of this spot, a portion of this site plan more affordable, like we did in Berry Gardens, and not with low-income housing, but just by the nature of connecting them and having less outdoor space and shared walls, a portion of the project becomes more affordable for other people.
I can only speak that we looked at many iterations. I will tell you that attaching homes together that are then for sale units, that doesn't necessarily make them any cheaper. Yes, you're building a little less exterior, but you're dealing with utilities running in various directions. It becomes actually very hard, not to mention the financing for that is very different. So that same firefighter, that same policeman who can go and get a single family loan because the mortgage lender totally understands that and totally values that, it has a harder time to get a loan on a different type of product for the same price. So I am not a real estate expert. I cannot tell you exactly where that would end up. I will tell you this product type is in line with your attached product density.
I think that those are all my questions right now. Thank you, Jim.
I want to go back to the driveway. So I don't know if Nick wants to come back up. I wonder if you can, is there any chance you can put up this picture? Is there one similar to this that's in the, that actually looks right down the throat? There we go. Yeah. So I guess when I look at this, and we're talking about a pedestrian-oriented, development, really the driveway here just dominates this whole development. And I appreciate that, yeah, people are going to drive here and walk around, but that's really not what I think a pedestrian-oriented development is what we're talking about. So for me, this is a pretty big deal. But I want to go back to two things. One is I also spoke to the transit and directly to the operator, actually. I think their concern isn't about a right-turn conflict. Their concern is that the bulb out that we put in to be part of our enhancement is just shaped wrong for a bus. It's basically they need to be a wedge shape, and we've built it as a square. And so by eliminating that and changing it and moving it down to the driveway, we can actually greatly improve the bus stop that exists. Just in talking to them, in fact, laying out I was out there today and pacing it off to see if their distinction about how much space they would gain, and actually it's quite a bit. So they would end up with essentially half of a full pullout. So I think for them the they would love the driveway to be gone, and then they could have a real pullout. But I in my opinion, it's probably the more valuable driveway. I would actually. So my question here, the other thing I observed there is, and you can see this a little bit in your overhead, is it actually that 7-Eleven store sits, I measured it 8 feet back from the curb. It's not right on the curb. And so I don't think you actually put your building right on the curb. So, but if you did put it on the curb, you'd have a 6 or 8 foot offset to that building as far as visibility goes. So I guess my question is that, because for me, this is one of the real critical issues, is there no other way to develop this project without the center driveway? I guess that... you know, I understand the thinking of you want this grand entrance, you want as many cars to get into it as possible. We're actually looking to, it may very well be the most pedestrian-oriented, you know, development on Grand right now, but is it really the ultimate pedestrian-oriented? So that's my question is this absolutely critical to the development of the project to have this entrance here?
I'll let Nick talk to that, but there was one thing I wanted to point out, and you may know more about this than I do, but because I'm hearing through our civil engineer, one of the things that we were hearing about putting the bus stop here was that they want the bus stop not near a traffic light.
I agree with you. They made that clear. They want to keep their bus stop where it is.
So they want to keep it here. But what they didn't like is they didn't want cars to be coming down Grand, pulling in front of the bus to make a right-hand turn into this. So if we can't do a right-hand turn here, then we'd like to be able to do a right-hand turn here rather than making people go all the way around to come back in here.
Yeah, and they did talk about it, but the real critical part to them is that they get a smooth exit that they can deal with. They deal with that in many other locations. Like they deal with that across the street.
Your question was, is it absolutely critical to have the center driveway to be a successful center, I guess. Is that okay? So can I ask, and I know I'm not supposed to ask, but is the issue the connectivity, or is it there is an extra bit of width between the two buildings because aesthetically I thought it gave a lot better feel and it made it where it was, people were going to be easier to be sitting down outside and all that by putting the center median, doing kind of a tree line median and kind of breaking it all up. Is it the distance between the two or just don't want to have any cars there at all?
Well, it's really having the cars there at all. I liken it to the issue that we dealt with some time ago over here when we were going to do Centennial Square. This is the same sort of an issue as, and we, you know, because of, for a whole number of reasons, we left the access point in here, but it's actually a less necessary access point in this development than it was here in the village. So I know at that time you were advocating eliminating that driveway and going with what would have been a very, you know, striking square there. And I'm wondering if this wouldn't be enhanced by something similar.
I mean, I think the fair answer is, I guess the real answer is I don't probably know. I mean, that's really what it really is, because it would be a very unorthodox layout. So I don't know that I've ever seen a corner deal develop with two anchors and nothing, you know. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of them, but I can't think of one right off the top of my head that has something where the parking is all in the back. Now, if the parking was in the front, which is ugly and everything else, piece of cake, because you have a way to loop right back around and it works. But the parking's in the back. It would certainly put an awful lot of burden on the size of the monument that you'd have to have, because you'd have to really get a monument out there that is all the way to the west, so that people know what they're passing, you know, before they pass it. Because once they pass it, then we got to hope they'll turn around and come back. So, I mean, it's kind of a trade-off, I guess, a little bit. One thing that I think is deceptive, and it's unfortunate the way it is in that layout, when you see two buildings like that, they look like they're 100 miles apart. I mean, they do when you look at the two of them out there. And yet if you overlay that and you look with the patios and the way that they're enclosed and the way it's actually, you know, there's a street and there's a median, but everything else is kind of used. And to me, it's a really a nice setting in the trees. Everything kind of forces people to kind of a nice slow entrance and everything else that's in there. It's a trade-off. Aesthetically, and I think operationally or functionally, to me, my opinion is it would work much better. If somebody said it just can't be there, I mean, that is probably something I would try. I think it'd be really weird, but I mean, I don't know, weird. It would just be different. So, I mean, I'd be, you know, it'd be a gamble. That's what it would be. It'd be more challenging with our tenants. I would say that. So.
One more question. Nick, I'm sorry. Can I ask one more question? I forgot to ask. The patio that's on the corner. I have been in a couple of developments down south recently where it's a little bit similar on the street. And then the patios are on the back of the property, interior to the project, and they face the parking lot, which when you say that, it sounds kind of, you know, ooh, who wants to face a parking lot? But these were designed, I mean, where the there are big patios, there's nice trees, there's landscaping, and I think it's a slower atmosphere to sit and look at a parking lot. It's maybe not as exciting as to sit on a street. And I think if you're in the village, I think a patio works. But I also think even in the village, I'd rather sit at the Rooster Creek patio than Andrini's, because you're sort of feel it's more mellow and protected versus, and this is the village. So I wonder if the patio might be more, I'm afraid that will get built on the end there and no one will sit out there. And so I thought if it was on the backside, and then especially if you sort of develop that back area where Jim's talking about, maybe if the driveway goes away and, you know, you could have almost a paseo and you could have public art and it could be pretty cool with some landscaping. Would the patio work for you or the tenant on the backside?
Well, I think, you know, there may be a little bit of both that might make some sense. I mean, one thing that you can do is narrow it up a little bit in terms of the width, lengthen the building, make it a little bit more shallow and bring the parking around the front so that maybe you have something that kind of, you have a little bit of both. One of the benefits of, at least from my perspective, is of having people that are on, especially if you're downwind, you know, so you're protected from the wind, the normal prevailing wind on that side of the building, is it's an advertisement for the restaurant. People sitting there make, if it's real busy, they go, gosh, now if it's empty, it's a mess. People go, that must be a lousy place. But if it's really busy, it's a great advertisement. So it's why they, you know, generally like to have, it's like a whole bunch of little mini monuments. But if you can, I think it'd be fine. There's certainly, it's if you don't have a bunch of people, you know, zipping by you, it is more of a, you know, it's a quieter, more ambient noise or less ambient noise. I mean, it's a nice, there's nothing wrong with it. It would be nice to have some ability to have some of that along the corner because it will help to drag in more customers.
Yeah, maybe you could sort of wrap it.
The side that really gets challenged is actually the west side of the east building. That patio is less functional for a couple of reasons. And I think that one has some need to be twisted a little bit. But I think that I just wanted to try to have, you know, I would have liked to have actually had four patios, but three is probably plenty. Because I think we're going to be able to use them and capture them. So I think there's certainly some refinements that we can do and, anyway.
Okay, thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's my only other question.
So I'll open this up to the public. Anybody from the public who would like to speak on this evening? The opposite of the last time. No takers? I'll close the public comment and bring it back to the council for comments. And I guess we'll start with Chris.
Okay, thank you for that. So I've just, I think I'll hit the questions that you asked, but I'll just go down my list. Tell me if I miss something. The driveway, the second driveway, I really agree with Jim that I think that we should eliminate that for pedestrian, paseo, patio, and I know what Nick is saying, that it might be odd if we kind of squished the buildings and we had a narrow path for just pedestrians. But I think that if you narrow that driveway a little bit, and it's not a driveway anymore, and you can still see down through the project, and you have patio tables out there, and there's some interest going on, and you kind of connect that to some patios on the other side, maybe with, you know, wrapping around the one on the restaurant, I think that that still has enough activity going on that people will pull over and if they miss the first driveway, go in the second driveway. I think it's such a nice commercial project overall, especially with the modern architecture, that I think that sticking a driveway in the middle of it and having cars going in and out, I just wouldn't want to sit there. I would look to sit on the back. So that's my two cents about the driveway. I think you can narrow it a little. Maybe the commercial gets a little bit bigger. And that way it's a real sort of a gathering area, focal point for the whole development. The patio I talked about, so those are my comments. I think that, unfortunately, Grand Avenue, even if we enhance it and we do the master plan, I don't think it's going to be a place where we're all, you know, we're going to want to sit outside on Grand Avenue. Unfortunately, it's just, it's busy, it's wide. I think that I'm afraid that if you build the patio right there on the corner and it doesn't wrap around, I mean, I think some people will sit there, but I think it might be empty a lot. I really do. So that's my opinion on that. The architectural styles, so I really like the modern on the commercial. I think that's something that Arroyo Grande really is asking for, something totally different to really set this project apart and maybe be the catalyst for other commercial projects on Grand. So I like that a lot. The residential style, you know, at first glance, I really like the mid-century modern. I really think that's, I like, that's my first choice. But then I also struggle with 42 units or 41 units or however many we come up with of that same style. Because I don't know if it'll look too cookie cutter. With the agrarian style, I think you can sort of change more colors and there's more detail where it looks a little more busy and not so plain. But I really like that mid-century modern. So I don't know a lot about architecture. So it would be maybe up to you if you guys think that you can make all those units look different enough to where they're not sort of just repeated. The units above, the residential units above, I appreciate those. I think you're going out on the limb a little bit because I agree. I hope those are rented right away, but this will be a good test. And I think I would hope that they'd maybe be a little bit smaller. And it's true mixed use, so we'll see if it works outside the village. So I'm struggling also with the density and then with the general plan and with the master plan. I'd love to have our master plan done, or whatever we're calling it, the East Grand Avenue Enhancement Plan number 2, have that done and be able to sort of look at that alongside this project. And, you know, Nick wants to wait. He doesn't want to wait for that to come and be completely finished and come to fruition. And so I struggle with holding off and having someone else do the project, buy the land, and do something that we don't want to see there. And so I'm struggling with that a little bit. The density, I'm willing for the commercial. I think with the commercial climate as it is, and the commercial broker I've talked to and some of the other council members have talked to commercial developers, and it's changed. And so I'm willing to go with less commercial. I think this is going to be a really quality project, the commercial that Nick's going to do. I like the residential above. I think that's going to be something we haven't seen before. So I'm willing to have less commercial. I'm still struggling with the density on the residential, not because for the general plan amendment, obviously that's something that's concerning, but also because I want this to truly be workforce housing. And I'm concerned that when, you know, you make it, you know, you have more land around it and it is single family, they are going to be worth more and they are going to be more expensive, I think they really are, than the attached townhomes or attached PUDs. So I think it's a nice project. I'm struggling with the general plan, and I would love to have this, you know, affordable. I would love to have this be workforce housing. And I'm not exactly sure with the detached single family, it's going to be affordable. So I think for now, those are my only comments. Thank you.
Get my microphone on here. First of all, I'd like to start with the concept of pedestrian-oriented. We constantly talk about having pedestrian-oriented things, and I'm not sure of what we could possibly do with this piece of property that would make people from this side of the freeway walk to it. Just not going to happen. So pedestrian-oriented to me means that people are going to come in and maybe go to one or two shops, or maybe they're going to shop and then they're going to go eat something and then stay in the general area. So with that in mind, I like the concept of having the driveway in the center. I kind of disagree. I think that that serves as an entryway that brings people in, much like what we did across the street. Perhaps we would make it one way in only, as we did across the street, so the people could turn right off of Grand into it, not left. If you're going to come in, you're going to turn the traffic light on Cortland and come in that way. But it would still be a visible entrance to the project. And I think that that's kind of important. I'd like the visibility to be there to the interior. But like I say, maybe making it one way in only and just having one lane coming in, that would work for me. And I think that the transit needs at the west end, perhaps that's a one-way out only. So that we kind of minimize the amount of people coming. No one's going to try and exit that and turn left onto Grand anyway. It's going to be very busy. So if people are going to turn left onto Grand to head towards the ocean, they're going to have to come out on Cortland and go that way anyway. And I think that's going to be a natural function of traffic flow. So I'm not too concerned about that. The issue of having the apartments up top, I really want that. I like having mixed use with some units above the commercial. I'd like to see them above both buildings, but if that's not possible, that's okay. And as a product of living in apartments growing up with my four brothers and sisters, we lived in apartments. That doesn't necessarily mean that families aren't going to be living there. That does provide a more less expensive media for people to maybe live there. And we might well find families that do end up living there. Not necessarily all of them, but that does provide an option. I struggled earlier on with the amount of commercial in this property versus the amount of residential, but I got to believe from what the experts are telling me that we just can't put more commercial in there. It's just not viable, not right now. And I'm not looking in a crystal ball and projecting out what it's like, but I don't know that it's going to radically change that much in the next decade or so. So I'm willing to accept this kind of a split with 10 to 12,000 feet of commercial in the front and the residential in the back with the residential on top also. In terms of the density, and I kind of like having them be single family units as they are with some space around them. I'd rather see that the way they are than having fences go up and try to create some sort of an outdoor space that could be claimed by each individual unit. I think having the shared central plaza area is a positive thing, and I kind of support that. In terms of the density, I think that putting 41 units in there plus the 6 or 8 that's going to be on top of the building is fairly dense. Which brings me to dealing with the general plan issues. And I read the staff report, and the staff report lists 6 different issues that says the conceptual project appears to be inconsistent with the general plan policy. And I'm not quite sure I agree with that. I think it's a question of interpretation on some of these policies, and I don't think that this project as such is going to be inconsistent with these policies. For example, LU 510.1, promote development of high-intensity mixed-use pedestrian activity nodes centered on the Cortland East Grand Avenue intersection. As a priority example of revitalizing this Court East segment known as the Gateway. Well, this will definitely revitalize this segment. I do think that it is, my interpretation is this, it may not be really high density, but it's high enough density that it meets my justification for that. It is mixed use. Pedestrian activity, we're going to create pedestrian activity by having 41 units inside there. People that live there will be able to walk to the commercial units that are there and to the commercial units that are across the street and up and down the block nearby. It does lend itself to that. So I'm not sure that it's inconsistent with that. LU 11.2, require that new development should be designed to create pleasing transitions to surrounding development. I think this is a good transition. Certainly, we don't have the housing units going in back from who's our developer on the housing units? Not Mangano Homes. The People Self Help. People Self Help is certainly going to be a little bit more dense than this, but I think this does create a nice transition from Grand into that, and then over back into Berry Gardens. It does fit. I don't think that it's a contrast. Some of the others, incorporating zoning regulations, developing, promoting infill development. This is infill development. We've got this large piece of property in there. We wanted it to be commercial, but we're not going to be able to do that, so we're going to infill it with residential. That works. So I'm not completely convinced that we have a real problem with the general plan here. However, as this develops and comes forward, and this is just the pre-app on this, as it develops and comes forward, we may find that there may be some inconsistencies with the general plan, and if that's the case, then we'll have to pursue a general plan amendment. And that's not an unheard of thing, and as long as we don't abuse that process, there's nothing wrong with doing that. In general, I think that this is a pleasing project that's coming forward. We're not going to see pure commercial in there. What I saw up in San Luis Obispo, the example we used, I liked what I saw up there. And certainly this is not going to be a carbon copy of that, and I wouldn't want it to be a carbon copy of it, but the concept is there. The vertical use for mixed development is there. And there's a pleasing set of 41 single-family condos, or whatever we're going to call them, inside that do lend themselves to being a little bit cheaper than the houses that are going to be in Berry Gardens. I think this is a positive thing. In terms of the traffic, in terms of the plazas and the seating that's going to be out on Grand versus possibly inside facing the traffic, facing the parking, I don't see people racing up and down Grand Avenue as it is. Traffic lights, particularly when you get down into Grover Beach, slow traffic down quite a bit. A lot of people are going down to the beach, and they're going to be slowed through here. It's not going to be an unappealing location. I don't think that it's going to be offensive. I think that the plazas with seating will get used in a very positive way. So I can support that. In terms of the mid-century modern style, residential versus contemporary agrarian, I kind of lean more towards the mid-century modern style and the contemporary commercial style versus Western agrarian, because it's not the village. I'd like to have some differentiation between there and here. But that's kind of the makeup that we put on it. Once we've accepted that there's going to be this kind of a project there, we can tweak with it. We can adjust what it looks like as we get closer in. And I'm confident that the architect can come up with things. Working with staff, we'll come up with something that appeals to us. What I'd like to see, though, ultimately in long term, is we've got the village here at this end of Arroyo Grande. Now we're talking about the gateway down at the other end of Arroyo Grande. I'd like to see both of those spiffed up and looking good. I think what we've done in the village is great. I'd like to see what we do down at the other end of Grand do the same. And then we can start working towards the middle and working on all the interior parts between here and there that need work, too. So I'll support this. Not wholeheartedly. I'm not going to give you a blank check here, but I think the project that's coming before us is going the right direction, and I think it'll be a good thing when it gets here.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with just a couple concerns, and then I'll go into the things that I'm appreciative of and I like about the project. The two major concerns I have are the general plan amendment. I started in this whole arena back in 2000 when we did the original general plan update, and I put a lot of faith and energy and effort into that whole project, and I understand the value of a general plan. So any general plan amendment that would come forward, it would have to be as narrow as possible, if at all. I think Councilman Costello brought up the idea maybe we don't have to, but if we're going to do it, it needs to be as narrow as possible, and I don't think it should be precedent-setting. It should be particular to this project, I think. The other thing that really bothers me about this project is that it's revenue-neutral. And staff has brought this up time and time again, we're running out of properties to develop, and we're getting to the point where we're getting close to build out, and so economically we're going to be looking at a different situation than we are right now as things level out, and so that concerns me that we're doing a revenue neutral project, and that's always something we have to keep in the back of our mind. That being said, I kind of want to move to the positive things I see about this project. And one is I've gotten practically dizzy looking at the different reiterations that we've done since I've been on Planning Commission. And Nick's probably sick to death of it. But I think we're finally getting to a situation where I had to come to the conclusion that this site was not going to be as intensely commercial as we had discussed. I think the applicant came forward and brought, you know, forward some really valid points regarding the change of that whole dynamic with less brick and mortar and more internet stuff, and just the current economic climate that calls for less of the type of commercial space that we originally envisioned. So it took me a while to wrap my head around that, but I think I've done that. So, and I think going forward, when we talk about the Grand Avenue Enhancement Plan and Nick wanting to go forward now versus not waiting, I think that's the right thing to do, because I think in this particular instance, this project might actually spur whatever we do going forward, and most developments that come forward aren't the basis of some plan that the city's put forward. They're rather penciled out from an economic standpoint to determine what works and what doesn't. So I don't think an enhancement plan is going to be the driving force here regarding economic development on that part of town. I think a good project, an anchor project, so to speak, or a new project, more modern looking, might give that part of Grand Avenue the boost that it's needed. I always feel like they get treated like the stepchild compared to the village and don't get the attention that they need down there. So I'm hopeful that this project will spur, you know, more creativity and more dynamic use of some of those buildings. We've already seen Applebee's come and go. We've seen a lot of empty space down that way, and that's discouraging. So I'm hoping that this will stimulate some sort of change. In terms of the driveway, if you guys really want to be different and you want to be, you know, groundbreaking, I think you need to consider not having the driveway and seeing that it's going to still be successful, because I think it will be. What else? In terms of the attached versus detached, Councilwoman Barnage brought up those issues, and I would just point this out from my perspective, and that is we have People Self-Help, which is attached housing, and I don't think we need to continue that ongoing. That served a particular need, and it's going to. The applicant said this is a new product, this is a different type of product, and I like that idea, actually. And from a loan perspective, I understand that detached walls versus attached walls make a huge difference. I get that. So I'm all for the detached housing part of this project. It is going to be different. And it seems to me like it's some in-between between People Self-Help and Berry Gardens. It seems like it's some middle ground there, I think, is the way I look at it. So anyway, those are my comments. I appreciate Nick's fortitude to keep coming forward and finally getting something I think we're going to get done. Again, like Joe said, I don't think this is a blank check. We're trying to give you general ideas on where to work. I think the modern architecture versus the agrarian is better, because, again, I think Kristen's right. I think we want to differentiate it from other parts of the area. So I look forward to see what you bring forward. I don't think we need to wait for an enhancement plan to go forward, because I think this will actually spur some discussion and some thought about what, in fact, will go on farther on down Grand Avenue. So those are my comments.
City Council, Before you get into your final deliberation, I just wanted to share a couple thoughts for consideration now that we've heard from everybody. And
what about Jim?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was giving you a chance to jump in there, Steve, but okay. I guess I'll start with your questions here, and then I'll come back to the driveway. So I'm certainly supportive of the overall concept here. I think that while I see the general plan with the attached housing specifically in it, I think it ends up being a distinction that really just has no practice. Actually, let me ask one question first. We're planning to do the Grand Avenue Enhancement Plan, but are we also planning to redo the Land Use Element Plan as part of that?
That's correct.
So we'll actually be revisiting the whole general plan independent of what we ever decided was a general plan amendment or not on this particular project.
That's correct.
Okay. I make that distinction because I think that is the one of the certainly critical issues is whether we would have to do a general plan amendment here or not. I think that clearly the way we've interpreted the general plan on the other areas here, there is room to make an interpretation that probably would approve this project. I mean, there could be some third rail in there that ultimately comes forward, but I don't see that. But as far as it being precedent setting, we're actually going to have the opportunity to set whatever precedent we want a year from now. So I'm not as concerned about that as I would be if we weren't moving forward with that. So I live in a zero lot line housing development. Granted, it is single story. I find the side yards, that's where we live. We have a backyard as well, fenced backyard. Our dogs love that, but we're almost never there. So I see this in my particular setup, it isn't split. It's what I call a true zero lot line. And the front and back side yards are by far the most useful part of our the exterior of our house, and we use it all the time. So I definitely see how this works. So I can see where having them not be attached is a plus for everybody. Everybody gets a private side yard, front and back. It works out really well if you line the windows right. So on that, I'm okay with that. And I've kind of commented here on the general plan amendment. I think that we can probably get there. I think we're also protected going forward by the land use element that we're going to review. I kind of stay away from trying to make judgments about architectural stuff because these drawings come in and then they build them and, you know, they don't look the same to me. I actually did not think that the bank building would be all that attractive a building. It's probably the best looking building on Grant. So, you know, I hope this is driven by the market much more than by us, frankly. If the market, I think it would be nice to see something different, and I think we have an opportunity here. I think that really what the reason for going to a modern look and something significantly different is to everybody will know where this is, because that's that modern place to go. They may hate it, but they'll know where it is. So like I say, on both sides of it, I think I would probably favor the modern look, but I'm, you know, particularly on the commercial side, but I don't have a real strong opinion on the residential side. So then let's get back to the driveway, because that is actually kind of a key element for me. And I will say that on the project across the street, the primary reason that I voted against that when I was on Planning Commission was because of the drive-through bank teller stations, whatever we should call those, the drive-throughs, and then they exit straight out onto Grand Avenue, and split up that. If you ever walk along there, if it was a heavily used, it turned out that they are not heavily used. But if it was heavily used, you're going to have a lot of traffic. You can't just hang out there. And I think the whole point of a pedestrian walk, if you will, is that, you know, you don't just hang out inside the parking lot and inside the stores. There's space to meet people out in front, not just in the really the private space that is the commercial zone. So you really want the public space. And I think that the opportunity to have the public space in front uninterrupted and the what would be some public space and probably bigger patios as well that you would get out of the center. I also think you could increase the size of the buildings. You know, if you eliminate that driveway, you've got another 25 feet to work with. One idea I wanted to throw out there, and this actually came up when I was talking to the bus people, and they're concerned about redoing that curb. And we were discussing how the pull-out bus stop across the street was created, and it was created by eliminating the parking on the street. I wonder if that isn't an opportunity here. One, if you eliminate the center drive, you probably pick up 6 street parking spaces, maybe more. Although if we're building a pedestrian orient, do we really want parking sitting right out in front of it? I will say that's one of the most distracting parts of sitting at the Starbucks across the street. There's constantly cars pulling and parking in front of you, and I would say that actually Grand Avenue is very noisy. You know, and sitting out in front of Starbucks, there's very few. I'm probably one of the few people that does sit out in front of Starbucks, and it's because it's noisy. They all go inside, or they move into the more interior patio there. So I actually think the interior patios are far more valuable than the street front patio. But if we were to do this, we would be making a statement. We would be expanding to a 10 or 15 foot sidewalk in front. I suppose there's the possibility of being able to articulate out over that sidewalk now because you've got more sidewalk out in front, so we would be creating a true pedestrian destination, I think, by doing that. I think that will be what makes this successful, you know, as a pedestrian. And I think that's sort of the concession that I'm looking for, is that if we're gonna do this, then let's give it every chance to be a successful pedestrian, and that we create really great public space. Hopefully, we're creating the Copeland's project, you know, that really sets the tone going forward. I'll just comment real quick on the apartments. I also think they probably need to reflect who's likely to stay there. Certainly, you know, many of us as kids grew up in apartments, but very few of us grew up in an apartment over the top of a store, unless we were in San Francisco or something. So I think that generally apartment families are going to be looking for something off the street. So I do think these are going to be singles, maybe a few couples. And really, I think you got to take a look at studios where you get a nice parking break. Okay. So those are my comments. I'm reasonably supportive of this, unless there's something that pops out that we're not seeing tonight. But I do think the center driveways really, really need to go. Okay.
I apologize for that. I was remembering your earlier discussion on driveways, so I thought you had already spoken. Just wanted to make kind of a recap of staff's position to this point in terms of maybe some involvement we could still have moving forward in terms of a few adjustments. It seems clear to us that there's we're probably not going to get much additional in a commercial, and there's probably not going to be support for high density residential in terms of apartments or anything like people's self-help housing and those type of things. So, but we do feel that we could make some additional suggestions to the developer that could probably keep the residential development in its current look and its current layout, but still maybe increase density a little bit to get us a little closer to those general plan policies to either be able to make those findings, or at least if we did need to do new policies, maybe they wouldn't be as significant in terms of the changes. So the one suggestion I wanted to throw out is to see if the council would be willing to direct the developer to come back and work with staff one more time in seeing if, you know, without completely redoing the layout or the look of the residential, is there some things we can incorporate and increase the density a little bit to get it closer to what we're trying to accomplish.
No objection to a staff working with the applicant. We've come a long way, and we're not completely done yet, so certainly continuing to work together is a productive thing, I think.
While I'm not opposed to staff talking to the developer, I'm happy with the density as it is now. It's already... Even the applicant said it was reaching a certain level of the density it was. And it was so many per acre. Was it 14 something? So I don't... The idea that we're going to try to craft a project that will all of a sudden keep us from having to do a general plan amendment or keep us closer to the current general plan is not as important to me is doing a well-planned project that makes sense, and I'm okay with what it is now. And I would hate for you to go back to the drawing board and have you raise concerns that I don't currently have. So, and maybe I'm making a mountain out of a molehill. Maybe you're only talking a few units or whatever. But my point is, I don't think one or two units, one direction or the other, is going to change how I feel about it, whether we need a general plan amendment or not. The real discussion between Mayor Pro Tem and Councilman Costello was, do we or do we not need a general plan amendment? And if so, what does that look like? That's more important to me than trying to craft a project at this point that clearly wasn't anything that we originally envisioned. It's something new and different, and we've had to come to grips with that. So, anyway, those are my comments.
You know, I'm okay with open communication. That's fine with me. It just makes a difference on what those changes were, because if it's a couple more units, I don't know how affordable that's going to become, because we had a couple more units in there. Then you're sacrificing green space. So I guess I'm sort of neutral on that. I mean, sure, I think they can talk back and forth. It just sort of depends on what the changes are that are suggested.
I don't have anything to really add to that. I do think. All right. Yeah, certainly we need communication between staff and the developer here, but I do think that most of the basic issues have been articulated here at council level. So I'm not sure, you know, if you come up with ways. I mean, I think we'd all love to see a little more density, but I don't think we want to kill the project to get it done. So. Did you guys get the direction you need? So with that, I will close this. There's no action necessary. And we'll go ahead and take it an 8-minute break. We'll be back by 8 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. I'm done by 8:30.
of the matter at issue. And in order for us to, for this council to act as the appeals board, I would suggest ample opportunity for the San Luis Obispo County Health Department and the owner, both of which are in the audience, to be able to speak, and then we can go to questions, provide another opportunity for any clarifications from any parties, and then the council can deliberate. The project is site is the Casa Grande Inn. This is the Best Western located off of Oak Park Boulevard and West Branch Street and near James Way. And you can see in the photo there's a pool that's currently constructed and some reconstruction modifications of that pool is what has brought us here this evening. In May, the City Building Division issued a stop work order and required a building permit from the city and approval from the San Luis Obispo County Health Department as well. The Health Department denied the pool plans and the owner has appealed. Since the county provides public health officer services for the city, that the city council then would serve as the local appeals board for the city and for this appeal. And I'll pass it over to John. He'll explain the construction that has taken place and the interpretation issue of the building code. And then, again, I would suggest to open it up to the San Luis County folks who are here and the owner, Mr. Bunnell, as well. So, John.
Thank you. Good evening, Mr. Mayor, council members. This is a before picture, as you see here. If you look where the cursor is, this was the spa up here in the elevated platform. This portion of the indented part of the pool, I'm a little loud here, was this indented portion here was cordoned off. A wall was built across here, and I'll advance it to the after portion. This wall here is what was built. I'll back it up again. This is the before picture. Here's the after picture. This is the wall that was built. This now became a spa with separate electrical, separate plumbing, separate heating. Again, back to the original, there was just the decking around the pool. For ease of access, it was required by code. This was constructed, this waterfall feature was constructed with a wall that popped out in front of it here for the waterfall water to come down underneath it at that time. That's the extent of the entire construction. We stopped work. The decking had not been completed at that time, and it stands as it as you see it in this picture as it is right now.
And with that, we can invite the County Health Department to come up and explain the matter, reason for the denial.
Good evening, Mayor Ferrara and City Council. My name is Kurt Batts, and I'm the Director of Environmental Health. And this evening, I'm here representing the health officer in this matter. The Director of Environmental Health and the health officer are the enforcing agents for Title 24, the State Building Standard Code, which the sections that we're talking about are in that section. As it relates to our, we are the enforcing agents as it relates to swimming pools, public swimming pools, but as a matter of fact. I wanted to bring up a couple of issues to clarify on the staff report that it's not clear to me the direction or at least the recommendation. One is it refers to approving a set of plans submitted. We've had actually two sets of plans submitted to us. The first ones were the ones that we rejected. A second set of plans were submitted to us that we approved, which did have the 8-foot or the 6-foot wall between the spa and the pool. It had the 4-foot deck. I'm sorry, was that a 6-foot deck between the spa and the pool, and a 6-foot or 4-foot deck between that rock feature and the pool. And that was consistent with what county, with what state building standard code allows for, and that's what we approved. So I'm not clear as to which plans are being referred to in here. The other thing, as I just mentioned, there was actually two reasons for our rejection of the plans. The staff report refers to one of them, and that is the 6-foot deck between the spa and the pool. There was actually another reason as well, and that is that rock waterfall. It is an obstruction to the requirement that the 4-foot deck be completely around the pool. And that rock feature serves as a obstruction to that deck. The reason a deck is very important, not only the 6-foot deck between the spa and the pool, but also on the end where that rock feature is. One of the most important reasons you have a deck around a pool is safety. In the event that someone is in distress in the pool, or someone is actually unconscious and you're trying to get them out of the pool, you want to have access as quickly as you can to the deck. The reason why it's 4 foot wide is because you want to get an injured person out on that deck to administer CPR or whatever other first aid you might need. So when we were considering this particular project, we did consider alternative construction, but the rock feature and the lack of that 6-foot deck between the spa and the pool is a significant safety issue in our opinion, and therefore we rejected the project. Otherwise, I am here to answer any other questions you might have of the health officer or the health officer's decision on this matter. Thank you.
Well, I do have a quick question while you're here at the podium.
Okay.
I'm listening to the reasoning for the 4-foot deck, and I was out there looking at that the rock feature the other day, and I'm not quite sure. It looked like it was maybe 3 feet between the wall and the back of the rock feature, but it's a guess. But I guess my question is based on the rationale that you've just shared with us, and that is safety, which I can understand the safety in terms of having access all the way around the pool, but the rationale of being able to pull someone out and administer CPR from the back of that rock feature, you have no access to the pool. You have no access to the water. So it would make sense that if you were going to pull somebody out of the pool, it would be very quick operation from the time that you got them out of the water until the time you administered CPR or whatever other emergency treatment. And based on the configuration, it's likely not going to be behind that rock waterfall. It's going to be out in the general area of the swimming pool. So I was wondering if you considered that at all.
Yeah, in fact, that's why we believe that the rock waterfall feature shouldn't be there, because it doesn't allow someone to get out on that end of the pool at all. The rock feature is in the way. So we would expect that either the rock feature be completely gone and the deck be right up against the pool, or the deck be in front of the rock feature, so that somebody could get on there. So we would not want that rock feature there, or we would want the deck between the rock feature and the pool.
Okay, thank you.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Yeah. In the alternative plan that you had, I understand about the rock feature. How was the 6-foot separation between the spa and the pool accomplished?
What he essentially intended to do in that second set of plans was to shrink the size of the pool. He was going to put a wall 6 foot inside of where the current wall is located and have a 6-foot deck between the spa and the pool.
Take a bite out of the pool.
Yes. Okay. And that's the same thing he would do on the rock feature side end of the pool.
And I've got a similar question to that. I've seen a lot of pools where you have the spa immediately adjacent to the pool. What's the difference between that and what we see here?
I'm not aware of any place in California that's like that, certainly not legally. The code, State Building Standards Code, requires between any pool and a spa or between any pool, adjacent pools, that there be a six-foot deck between the spa and the pool or two different pools.
That's six feet in width?
In width, yes.
And is there any requirement for any walls?
I'm not
Would there be a wall between the two?
Well, there would be a six-foot-wide
space.
Between,
but there's nothing that calls for a wall to be in there?
No, there's nothing that mentions a wall, only that it be a deck between the two. By the way, this is for, if there's any confusion, this is for public swimming pools, which do not include your typical backyard pools.
So just to follow up on Joe's question, because I've seen pools too, pools and spas too, where the spa is in the pool with a little thin, like this, a little thin row of tile. Now, I'm recalling those are actually my girlfriend's pool is like this, and so that's different. So you brought up that point. But I thought I'd seen also, wow, this is loud all of a sudden. I thought I had seen also commercial pools at hotels. Now, is this a new rule? Or maybe I've been in a pool at a hotel that's 10, 12 years old, and maybe that was an old, it was okay that back then?
Mr. Bunnell actually provided me with a number of pictures of various pools that were arranged similarly that he is proposing here. And as we researched that, all of them were out of state, or there was a few of them that were in the state, but they were at casinos, and casinos are Indian land, and I have no jurisdiction, neither does anybody else in the state have jurisdiction over Indian land. The only one that he did show me was in the city of Blythe, which is on the eastern end of Riverside County out near Arizona. Mm-hmm. And there was one there that was, when we followed up on that, it was built in 1964 and was prior to the County of Riverside having a program, and they have allowed it to stay.
Okay, so maybe a pool I've been in that's like that is just, it's something that's outdated. I mean, that where it's not separate, that's something that I could have been in. It's just they don't do that anymore. It was allowed prior is what I'm saying.
I've been in this for about 40 years now. And I don't know when that law might have changed, but it's been pretty much like this the whole time.
Okay. And then you talk about the 4-foot deck needs to be completely around the pool. Okay. So not talking about the spa, but looking at that waterfall feature. So obviously a waterfall has to be next to the pool because that's a waterfall. But you're talking if there was 4 feet in front of the waterfall, then that would be okay. But something up against the pool, it has to have 4 feet between the pool and whatever that is.
That's correct. Okay. And the waterfall, by the way, falls into a chamber, not into the pool.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's actually a completely separate system.
Okay. All right. Okay. And then I just have a question of staff. Is that next? Should we do that now or later?
Or when we finish with the presentations.
Okay. That's it. Thank you.
Any more questions for Health Department?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We may ask you to come back up later. Okay. All right. So we'd like to hear from the applicant now. Pardon me, the appellant.
Got to get the language right here.
My name is Ray Bunnell, owner of Casa Grande Inn. And I was not going to give you a lot of information, but I think I'm going to have to.
Ray, can we get you to pull that mic down a little bit? Thanks.
Yeah, wasn't planning to give you a lot of information based on your staff report. By the way, I think staff did an excellent job of researching the situation and the codes, and certainly I concur with their conclusions. But I'd like to comment some on the the waterfall issue. The code, even though it says that you need a deck 4 feet around the pool, it also says that that deck can go around behind diving boards, diving platforms, slides, and handicap accessories. Now, it does not mention waterfalls, but it seems to me that there shouldn't be any problem going around a waterfall if you can go around all those other things. And not only do we have 4 feet around most of the area, except we are a little short behind the waterfall, but on each side of the waterfall, we have a full 8 feet, which is double the required standard. I can show you that code if you'd like, but I know the building official is very familiar with it. The other thing I would like to show you is some photographs. I've got a whole series of photographs here, but I've got one open that I'd like for you to look at.
Okay, maybe we can get those put up on the overhead.
This is in Palm Springs, California, at a hotel there. Shows a double water slide with boulders in between and on each side, and there's no deck wrapping around behind them. The deck stops on each side of that feature. There's another one behind that, or in front of that, in the same area, same situation.
Are these private homes or are these commercial?
No, that's commercial hotels, and I do not believe that those are on Indian reservations. And my thought on the Indian reservations, I understand that they're not subjected to California code, but I do believe that they are subjected to national code, which does allow such structures. There again, you can see that the deck stops on each side of the water slides and boulders, and does not appear to go around it. The one picture that he referred to in Blythe, California, would be the very first one there. Very similar to what we've done. And the thing about the 6 foot requirement is it refers to multiple pools. I don't think that particular pool that you're looking at there would be considered multiple pools. And we don't consider ours as a multiple pool because we simply put the spa inside the existing pool shell, which there are a number of advantages to that. One is it saves water. If we had built a separate spa, we would have had more water. We actually eliminated the spa we had, and now we are using even less water than we had in the original pool. Also saves energy. And there's a whole variety of pictures there. Some of them are at Indian hotels, but and a number of them are in other states. We researched about 10 states and found pools like that. And I know that Mr. Hurst has also looked into the pools in other states. Here's another picture that shows a waterfall in San Luis County, in San Luis Obispo, adjacent to a large spa with no deck in front of it.
Where is that?
That's at the Rose Garden Inn in San Luis Obispo. There's also a similar one in Pismo Beach at the Quality Inns. As far as safety goes, I wanted to give you another plan. Got one of these for each of you, or we can put it on the screen. That's the pool as it's built. And the yellow represents the deck, unobstructed deck going all the way around, including behind the waterfall. The pink that you see there with the dotted circle, that's where we proposed a handicap lift, which serves both the pool and the spa. And we designed it that way on purpose so that we didn't have two of those. Because if you put the 6-foot deck in there, then you're required to have a second handicap lift. And those things very seldom ever get used, and they're safety hazards, you know. Kids run around, run into them, and they like to play on them. So our design allows us to use one for both the pool and the spa. Right behind that is the second plan that the health department referred to. That was only submitted to the health department because I got to a point where I thought I had no choice. And it was after I submitted this plan that I learned that I could appeal to the city of Rio Grande. But that's what the health department required us to do for approval. You can see it leaves us with a very small pool. And you probably can't read those notes, but essentially what that deck in front of the waterfall does is it invites kids to run and play at the waterfall. And also, all of that deck area creates a runway between the pools for kids to run back and forth. And in my opinion, it's not near as safe as the pool as constructed. That, you can see another dotted circle on the left there. That's where the second handicap lift would have to go if we were to build that plan. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Can I see that section of the code you were talking about that referred to the diving board and the reference to the waterfall, please?
Yes.
Thank you. Those are my only questions of the applicant.
What's the depth of the water at the pool right in front of the waterfall?
4.5 4.5 feet. The pool, that's the deepest part of the pool, and the at the other end is 3.5 feet. Another thing regarding safety is our pool is only 18 to 20 feet wide. And you know, it's not like a lot of pools in California that'll be 40, 50, 60 feet wide. So it's not that hard to get to somebody to get them to the deck space that we do have. We can actually reach all the way across the pool with our hook pole.
Can you put up the drawing of the pool as it is now? What's the depth? Is the pool 4.5 feet is here as well?
Yes.
And this is probably 3 feet with a bench that's...
It's three and a half feet.
Okay. And you said this distance here is 8 feet and this distance here is 8 feet?
Yes, the deck space there.
Well, I'm talking about the distance between the corner of the pool. What I'm looking at is if you had to pull somebody out of the pool here, you've got this distance here, which I'm going to guess is if these are 8, this must be 16.
I'm sorry, what? I'm not understanding your question.
Okay, so this is the rock feature here.
Yes.
What's the distance from the edge of the rock where you could pull somebody out of the pool to the corner of the pool?
That's about 5 feet there, and it's about the same on the other side, 5 or 6 feet.
So the I'll call it the missing section here is about 10 feet.
Right. That's correct.
We can't hear you if you talk away from the microphone.
Okay, I just thought it was easier to get this one, but okay. Okay, so this distance here, is that 5 feet?
Yes.
And this distance over here, is that 5 feet?
Yes.
So now this does look a lot larger than that. So what is the distance that is inaccessible because of the rock feature?
It's approximately 10 or 11 feet. Now, in that picture, you will see that there's some rocks on each side of the waterfall. We have agreed that we will remove those rocks on each side of the waterfall so that that deck area, that 8-foot deck area, is easily accessible.
Okay. All right. So part of what we're seeing in this picture is actually going to go away. So there'll be 8 feet here, there'll be 8 feet here, and there'll be about a 10-foot section that is inaccessible directly from the edge of the pool.
That's correct. The rocks right there where your arrow is, those will be removed, and there's one on the other side right there that will be removed.
Okay.
And we agreed to do that
for
better access.
Just reconfirming the same picture. So it's about 4 feet here, and then there's a bench. Does the bench go all the way across? In the drawing, it didn't look like it did. Does the bench seat go all the way across the spot at this point?
Except for about 3 feet.
Which is down in this corner here.
Right. That's correct.
All right, thank you.
Now, the bench coming from the other direction does go all the way to that corner.
Yeah, but along the edge of the pool.
There's probably about a 2-foot space there. It doesn't have a bench.
Okay. Any other questions for the appellant?
No.
Okay. Thank you. Now, was there some other comments that you would like to make?
I did want to refer to the one picture he showed of that waterfall, what looked like next to a spa. And the code does allow for the deck to only be around 50% of the spa. So that picture you saw, where you saw a waterfall, and it looked like a spa. It was a pretty small pool if it wasn't a spa. I couldn't tell from the picture. But that was actually, that would be allowed by code, because around a spa, you only have to have 50%, the deck only has to go around 50% of the spa. The requirement for the deck to go completely around the pool as distinguished from a spa. And the other point I wanted to make is in terms of the issue of two pools, this spa is a completely separate pool. It has a separate purpose, separate recirculation. It is divided by a wall. It is separated from the pool by that wall, which is about a foot wide at this point. So it is, in the opinion of the health officer and myself, is that it is two separate pools, which is why we have the requirement of the 6-foot deck.
Okay. Thank you. This is obviously not a public hearing, but if there's anyone in the audience that would like to come forward and comment on this item, this would be your opportunity.
I love this. Can I have that yellow drawing? Yeah. You all might not know this, but I'm retired RN, PHN, MICU qualified, EMT qualified.
Get your name for the
record. Gail Lightfoot. Okay. Sorry, Tony. I'm looking at this, and I'm wondering, it would be nice to get the opinion of an EMT as to whether or not they could safely remove someone from this pool and administer CPR. I think, from my experience, you definitely could.
Okay, thank you very much. Anyone else who would like to come forward and comment on this item? Okay, seeing no one, we'll close public comment on the item. Let me go back to staff. Anything else that you would like to add and before we discuss this?
When this was brought to my attention, I researched the code, and I wanted to just tell you my opinion and my interpretation of the code about the two structures. The code says where multiple pools and or spas are built adjacent to each other, the deck width separating them shall be a minimum of 6 feet. My opinion is these are not multiple pools or spas built adjacent to one another, because the pool shell structure was built a long time ago, and this is just adding a wall separating the two. That is just my opinion, and that's how I interpreted this code.
All right. You can ask your questions as we do comments, okay? So why don't we start to my right, and we'll see where everybody is at on that. So Councilmember Costello.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mayor. I guess I'll start with a question for staff. So am I to understand that we're the final arbiters of this? We have the ability to override the health department.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I went out and looked at the site myself, and I didn't focus on the waterfall. I admit that I focused on the spa area and the existing pool, and I don't see any need to have a six-foot deck between those two. I'm of the opinion that Jonathan is, that this was an existing pool with a wall put into it that just separates the two. They may have different circulation pumps, different circulation, different heating systems for the two, but I do see this as a single unit. I am a little bit more concerned in the second look, looking at the waterfall area and the accessibility. Comforting to me is the fact that it's only 4.5 feet deep. Now, mind you, I've had swimming lessons several times in my life. I don't swim. I don't float. I sink. So you can drown in a foot of water. So the fact that it's 4.5 feet versus 6 feet or 8 feet or 10 feet, relatively not a great deal of difference. If the applicant is willing to remove the rock on the sides to create a wider space on the two flanks of that waterfall and create a more serviceable area to where people would be able to get in and get somebody out, I can live with that, and I will support that.
Okay. Councilmember Brown.
I'm ready to move forward and uphold the appeal, and I don't have anything further to add.
Okay. Councilmember Barnidge.
Thank you. My question was, Jonathan, I'm sort of thrown off because I was more or less okay with the pool and the spa being next to each other and not having 6 foot, 4 feet in between the two. But this waterfall thing wasn't called out in the staff report, and now I'm totally thrown off because I feel like that's a big obstacle. And if you read the code here, it says that you can have, you know, if you don't maintain that 4 feet, you don't have to maintain it if you have a diving board, a fixed disabled access assistant device, or a slide, and the waterfall isn't called out. So to me, it doesn't give us much wiggle room to say, well, waterfall. I mean, it's a safety thing for me, so it's concerning. Is that something, I wonder why it was left out of the staff report. It concerns me. Because that's a bigger deal, I think, than the pool and the spa, because that really seems like one pool just separated by that wall. I will say that there is plenty of room besides where the waterfall is to pull someone out, but oddly enough, one of my very good friend's boyfriend just pulled 3 drowning people out of a pool in Hollywood about 4 days ago. And
he pulled them out. Someone administered CPR to them, and two people are probably not going to make it, but the one 12-year-old boy is. All three people couldn't swim. The mom jumped in to save the 11 and 12-year-old and pulled these three people out. So in that instance, it probably was a deeper pool. But if they were over in that corner right in front of the waterfall, the quickest way to get them out would be to get them out right there, to kind of go over here and get them out. For that reason, I think that concerns me, but also because unless someone from staff gives me a good reason that we should deviate from the code, I'm not comfortable with that. So those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem?
Actually, have similar concerns on the waterfall as well. When I looked at this and was looking at the pool, I certainly understand that they're really effectively one pool. You do have a space where it would be somewhat more difficult to pull somebody out between the spa. But when I look at the when I see the combination, can I see your pointer? When I see the combination of this section here plus this corner, and then the 10 feet or whatever it is disappearing here, I this is a much bigger obstruction than a diving board or a slide. And I guess I would want to hear from Jonathan on what his thinking there is on this, which in this picture is probably about 12 feet. I can see the two pools being, you know, are really one, but I am concerned about the rock waterfall.
If we look on his map here, it shows that there's 11 feet here. If that's accurate, this dimension of that waterfall width would be 11 feet. And if we determined the distance from the edge of the waterfall to the spa, and Ray, I think you said it was 5 feet. So we're looking at 14 feet till you hit the edge of that spa. So you're right, that's quite the distance. And as a former medic in EMT too, from many years ago, I totally understand drowning children. I've been there and done that many times. Doing CPR on infants is not one of my favorite things, and I've been there many times. So I have to agree with you. This is not the most optimum thing. The reason it was left out of the staff report is because waterfalls are not addressed in the code. It's just not there. If there was a slide on the thing, then I could address that in the code, and that's why it was just not addressed, for that reason only.
So I guess when we're reading the code, they call out several things as specifically exempted, but this is not exempted. So in your interpretation, you're saying that it's similar and therefore is.
I would agree with you, yes.
That's how you're interpreting it?
Yes.
Okay.
I would have to lean that direction, yeah.
I guess my concern here is that this is a significantly bigger obstruction. I'm not quite sure we're communicating the same thing here.
I think what Jonathan's saying is that he's in agreement that it's materially different from the items specifically exempted in the code. We are staff report suggests interpreting the pool structure to be one structure, and the wall, therefore, to be allowed, but we would be in agreement with this health officer on the waterfall obstruction.
Okay. All right. I'm glad you clarified that, because I wasn't getting that. Because I mean, at minimum, I would want to see the waterfall restricted to, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 feet, something like that. I realize that doesn't fit what's built, but in looking at it here and understanding what the purpose of the code is, of requiring the access all the way around the pool, I think this is just too big a section of the pool lip as being inaccessible. I felt pretty comfortable approving the relative inaccessibility at the spa, but this particular section, particularly putting the two together, I'm uncomfortable with. And when you have that corner, is I'm going to say the most dangerous corner in the. It would be relatively difficult to get to somebody right in front of the waterfall. So that's my input.
Okay. I spent probably, I don't know, maybe 15 minutes 20 minutes out there the other day and yesterday. And the comment that was made with regard to removing the rocks on the periphery here, those rocks, as I recall, were probably a good 2.5 feet in width, perhaps a little bigger. The boulders on either end of the waterfall that you were going to remove, what about how what was it, about 2.5 feet? Okay. So that's about right here on both sides. And, excuse me, I'm looking at this, I think, from a set the code aside. I'm looking at it from an operational standpoint relative to safety. And and I could stand right here with those boulders, put a knee down on that border wall, and reach over and grab somebody if I had to, and pull them out. You can do that from either side with those peripheral boulders set aside. I'm not seeing a safety hazard here. I'll qualify that. There was one safety hazard that concerned me. And that was the backside of that waterfall, without any mitigation, would have been kind of a temptation for kids to climb on. And if that were the case, we would have some issues there. We talked about some potential mitigation for that, which I'm relatively comfortable with. But the notion of the waterfall being an obstruction from a safety standpoint, spending time out there and looking at accessibility, I'm not seeing it. I'm just not seeing it. It's four feet of water, 4.5 feet of water. It would stand to reason that, and of course there are no guarantees, but a mom with a kid, especially kids that can't swim, are going to stay right here on the steps with their mom. You know, I guess I'm just not seeing an issue here with that waterfall. Again, looking at the discussion relative to whether it's two pools or one pool, I think all you have to do is look back in the corner at where the spa used to be. That particular area up there, the reason why it's still not up there, as I understand it, is for disabled access. There was no way that you could get access up in there. That constituted a second pool. This essentially transformed a single pool into a spa that's divided from the main pool. That's how I see it. So I'm not seeing it as two separate pools per se that would drive the need for the deck that the code requires for two separate pools. So I'm, you know, again, I'm looking at this thing from kind of a common sense safety operational point of view, and I'm not seeing where this design gets in the way of that. So I'm, you know, at this juncture, with those two boulders removed on either side, and with some mitigation on the back of that waterfall that would deter kids from climbing up there and maybe going over the top of it, I'm ready to move forward and uphold the appeal. So those are my comments.
So in the end, I don't think I'm going to be able to support this tonight, but I do hope that if it does go forward, you'll specify what the distance can be because of the precedent setting here. Is the next rock, the next waterfall going to be 20 feet wide? And I would, you know, because you are establishing, at least in Arroyo Grande, that this is the equivalent of a slide or a, so I'd hope you'd set whatever that distance is, you know, whatever it's built at,
so that you'll in fact know exactly what somebody's approving and looking at in the future.
Can I make a comment, Mr. Mayor?
Sure.
I would agree. I can't support this tonight. I would agree with Councilmember Guthrie. I will just add, you know, looking this again, the people that drowned in L.A., they couldn't swim, and they were in the deep end. I don't know why their mom let them go in the deep end, and she couldn't swim either. So to think that people that can't swim are going to stay in the shallow end, I don't agree with that at all. I think kids will just sort of end up in water where they can't swim. And then if you're going to pull someone out of that area where the waterfall is, if you were going to stand on there and pull them out, I could maybe see that. But if they're sunk down, unconscious, on the bottom of the pool, and you have to go down and swim, and then you have to lift them out or give them to someone to do CPR, there's no place there. So that's why I can't support that tonight. Sorry that it's built. So those are my only comments. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments?
Again, Mr. Mayor, I've got the luxury of having my iPad here, and I've got the picture expanded up greatly. And from my vantage point looking at this, from the edge of the pool, could I borrow the pool? If we go from the edge of the pool here to the edge of the waterfall there and remove those rocks, and I'm not sure that's one rock, it looks like it's three or four, that looks to be creating a space 4 to 5 feet wide. I can support opening that up. And the same thing on that side. As long as we open it up and leave a wide enough space so that there would be access for rescue workers to get in there. Again, kids are going to go where they shouldn't be. Just because someone can't swim and the mother is there doesn't mean that 1 minute in attention can create a tragedy. So I think we need to make sure that we have a wide enough area on both sides of that waterfall that we will be able to get access in there to take care of it. And I'll support that. I won't support it the way it sits right now, but I will support it if we widen, get rid of the rocks, and leave a wide enough area in there.
Okay. Anyone, anything else? All right. Anyone want to try a motion?
So Mayor, if I could suggest, you have a resolution in front of you. It has certain findings, but it also has an action clause, the now therefore be it resolved.
David, I can't hear you.
Oh, okay. if I can suggest, you have a resolution in front of you with regard to the appeal, and there is an action clause, the now therefore be it resolved portion of the resolution that reads that the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande hereby upholds the appeal and approves the Best Western Pool plans, perhaps adding a comma and adding the words subject to removal of the rocks on either side of the waterfall consistent with appellant's testimony at the hearing might be a way to take action on it, given what I sense is the majority of the council on this item.
Okay. All right. Anyone want to try a motion?
Mayor, I'll move adoption of the resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande upholding the appeal of the decision of the San Luis Obispo County Health Department, thereby approving the pool plan submitted by the Best Western Casa Grande and subject to the inclusion of language in the findings for approval that the rocks will be eliminated on the two flanks of the waterfall.
Is that it? All right. We have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Any further further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
No.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
No.
Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate you taking time to be here this evening.
Okay, that's going to take us to 11B. This is a consideration of alternatives to address complaints regarding late evening noise and disruptions in the village. And good evening, Chief.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. We're here to talk about some late evening noise and disruptions issues and some alternatives we may have for that. If I could give you just a little brief background that you, I'm sure, saw from the staff report. But as you know, Council recently received a complaint regarding late noise in the village, some disturbances primarily related to one establishment in the village. However, we have received complaints for different related activities in the area before. Most of the complaints have to do with loud music. However, they do also turn into damage to city property, fights outside the establishments, people yelling, and other noise-type complaints. So as far as our response, the police department has responded to all the complaints that we've received. However, most of the time, the enforcement on those complaints has been in an attempt to get voluntary compliance from the owners of the businesses involved. Our current noise ordinance in the municipal code is based on noise decibel meter levels, and quite frankly, it's a very cumbersome and difficult process to enforce that, especially if you're talking about late at night, police officers going to that call. And so most of the time, what we've tried to do is, again, gain compliance from the businesses at the time. However, the ordinance, since it is limited to the decibel meters, is causing us kind of an ongoing problem because we cannot give a real clear standard for the businesses, especially out in the field. Meanwhile, as we know, the city's been working a lot on economic development in the village. The village is way more vibrant than it was a number of years ago, and on not only weekday nights but definitely weekend nights, there are quite a lot of activities in the village. When we were looking at this and what we could do to introduce some new regulations, we did not want to have a disincentive for the businesses to do well. We want them to continue to do well, but we also want to be proactive and address some of these problems in a reasonable way. And so staff met and are looking at some alternatives, and some of those are before you tonight. I'd like to cover those quickly. There's three. Recommended action is the current decibel meter, the current decibel-based noise restrictions are designed to address noise levels from all types of miscellaneous sources, and we believe that it would be more effective to add restrictions to specific noise-generating activities that the city identifies as a problem. For example, any outdoor amplified music ending at 10 p.m. And if I can elaborate a little bit on that, you can see pretty easily that when police officers have to arrive for a noise complaint, we have the choice now of trying to have some decibel meters that would be set up and get a reading, or simply saying that by 10 p.m. The outdoor music or amplified music needs to stop. Much easier on the latter to enforce and gain compliance. So that is one of the first recommended actions. The second is to recommending that we look to develop a nuisance abatement provision of the municipal code, add to it, amend it, so that it allows us to respond to the incidents that we have. And if we have multiple complaints, then this nuisance abatement would allow us to address those ongoing problems if there's not compliance. Currently, our nuisance abatement does not cover that, and we would like to see some research done by the city attorney's office to help us look at a comprehensive nuisance abatement ordinance modeled after some cities similar to the one in the city of Oakland that's been upheld in the Court of Appeals. Again, that will allow us to deal with ongoing problems if we don't get compliance, which would be helpful. The couple of the businesses in question, just so you know, are operating, and this is a little out of my league because it's kind of community development, but I would say operating under the legal nonconforming status. In other words, they've been around so long that we don't even know what the original agreements were as far as their use. And so we don't have the same restrictions on them. And so this nuisance, public nuisance ordinance would allow us to work to correct some of those problems because they're not exempt from any public nuisance then. So though that's the second choice. And then the third, which is a very important piece, is the police department is going to work both with the fire department and our building inspections to clearly establish occupancy loads for some of these businesses. Some of the problems that we're seeing is based on exceeding that occupancy standard where people boil out of some of the establishments into the street either in front or behind the establishment. And then, of course, that's when you have issues regarding fighting and other problems that exist. So those are the three things we're looking to do. Again, what we're asking the council to do is to direct staff to prepare an ordinance that would prohibit outdoor amplified noise after 10 p.m., a clear guideline after 10 p.m., and amend the nuisance abatement procedures to provide the police department increased authority to address complaints and to appropriate $2,500 for costs related to the preparation of the ordinance. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Oh, I did forget one thing that the city manager reminded me. Part of the issue regarding the noise abatement as far as at 10 p.m. would be also to have other items within that ordinance to require the closing of the doors or have the music at a certain level so that it doesn't go outside the business. So not just end outdoor music at 10 p.m., but close the doors. I forgot that because I was thinking about the occupancy. Most of the time those doors are open because they're overflowing out through the doors.
Okay. Questions?
I have questions.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. So what you just brought up, Chief, about the outdoor amplified noise, I definitely think that's a good thing. But I think that a lot of the complaints come from noise that's not amplified, that's not inside, or I'm sorry, it's not outside, it's inside, it's leaking out. So the doors are open, the jukebox or the music is playing, people are yelling. So what was the, you just sort of changed the language, or it's not language necessarily.
Kind of a three-prong approach. First would be to shut down the music, outdoor music, as you said, amplified music at 10 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
But along with that, require them to abate some of the noise as far as closing the doors in the establishment. That's important to have that noise from going outside the business, but also it involves, as we said, the occupancy load. A lot of times the doors are open for that. So get the occupancy down to an acceptable level, have them shut off the outdoor music at 10 p.m. and close the doors so that they're able to keep the noise inside. And if we continue to have problems, the nuisance abatement would allow us to come back and address it by that way.
I think the way we figured it would be structured is no amplified noise would be allowed outside after 10 o'clock, and then also after 10 o'clock, any indoor amplified noise would mean that the business would have to keep the doors closed at that time.
Okay, and then I wasn't really aware of any outdoor amplified noise in the village after 10 o'clock. So when I think of the only outside amplified noise, I think of Branch Street Deli that closes down way earlier than 10 o'clock. And so someone did mention on staff or maybe Councilmember Guthrie that Ralph and Duane's has outdoor speakers on a patio in the back that I wasn't aware of. And that's something that we've run into problems with before. Do they still have those?
Yes, sometimes they've had live music. Other times they have the speakers that come from the band that's inside or the music being played inside, outside. And Bill's has also done that in the past, too.
Okay, and so as it stands currently, so they're still playing that music sometimes until 11 or 12. We've gotten complaints, the outside amplified, I mean, on that patio?
We have.
Okay. Okay, those are my only questions. Thank you.
How did you come up with 10 o'clock?
I think, I don't recall, actually. I think, Steve, we discussed what a time period was, what we thought might be a reasonable time period, not to interfere with their businesses, but also have something reasonable as far as what the residents that live around the area would be interested in.
Yeah. Steve, is that your bedtime?
Yeah. It's a little past my bedtime. We felt it was, as the chief said, the kind of the first test was we felt it was probably the most reasonable time as far as allowing the establishments to have that music outside up to where it doesn't negatively impact their business, but then at the same time, it's the reasonable time for people that in the area for to be able to cut off that outside noise. And then we did check with the deli, who seems to be the ones that most utilizes outdoor entertainment, and they indicated they felt very comfortable. They are permitted to go to 10 o'clock. They normally stop at 8:30, mm-hmm. but their ABC permit allows them to go to 10 o'clock. So when we verified that, it all seemed consistent with the feedback we were getting that 10 o'clock, everybody seems to feel is a pretty reasonable compromise.
And just realize that that's the outdoor music, so they can still continue on inside.
Mm-hmm. One quick question. Chief, could you elaborate a little bit on the process, on the public nuisance process? As I understand it, something like that could result in a warning. It's kind of a progressive thing. So a warning, if there isn't compliance with the warning, a citation. And then if there are repetitive citations, then the nuisance issue could engage, and then we might be talking about a business license suspension. Is that generally the progression
perhaps if
that
I can,
it follows?
Perhaps if I can jump in on that. First of all, it wouldn't be related to the business license because that's not regulatory, it's a tax. And as was mentioned, businesses we're dealing with are legal non-conforming. The state has preempted regulating alcohol and establishments that sell alcohol, except they allow cities and counties to require permits under their zoning ordinance, conditional use permits for such businesses, and that's what occurs here. For newer businesses. However, older established businesses, Bill's, Ralph and Duane's, for example, were established prior to that requirement, and therefore they're legal nonconforming. The problem with establishments that serve alcohol or sell alcohol, off-sale businesses as well, is not unique to Arroyo Grande. Cities all over the state have grappled with this issue. The city of Oakland came up with a comprehensive ordinance a number of years ago that was litigated, and there's an appellate opinion that came out in 1996 upholding the scheme that they adopted, which is a very comprehensive scheme that deals with more than just noise, other kinds of problems that occur at drinking establishments, such as fights and a lot of police calls and just various things that are outlined in the ordinance that constitute a nuisance are addressed, and business is required to meet certain standards so that they don't constitute a public nuisance, or there are remedies, and I still need to research that further. There's about 20 ordinances like this that have been adopted around the state, and they vary a bit. But they provide a remedy where there can be fines, penalties, appeals to either a planning commission or city council, and possibly even revocation of the right to continue to do business if it gets to an extreme. Obviously, in any kind of code enforcement effort, there's usually the approach of trying to get voluntary compliance, so that would be incorporated, I'm sure, into any implementation of an ordinance like that. But again, these ordinances are a tool that quite a number of cities have moved towards to deal with those businesses that serve alcohol that create a lot of problems that require police responses.
Okay. Mr. Mayor, could I follow up on that? So, David, would the fact that they're legally nonconforming, we'd still have the right to take some sort of action with the nuisance provision?
Yeah, that case specifically addressed that issue and said that even though a business was legal nonconforming and had a right otherwise to exist, they didn't have a right to operate in a fashion that constituted a public nuisance.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. If there are no other questions, once again, not a public hearing, but if there's Anyone in the audience that would like to comment on this? Anyone? Okay, not seeing anybody rush to the microphone, so we'll bring this to the council and start to my left with Councilmember Barnidge.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. No, I'm ready to move forward with this and have staff research how we can try to manage the noise in the village. I think because of the way the village sits down low, and maybe the residence is not so much on that side of the village, but the residence is behind us. It's sort of a fishbowl. And I think that the complaints we have had are mostly up above, and it sort of carries. So I do think 10 o'clock is reasonable for the noise. I think 11, you know, something later, I just think is too late for people trying to go to sleep. So I think that's reasonable. And I had something else to say, but I can't remember. Those are my only comments, I think.
Okay. Councilmember Brown.
I agree. Anything that give the police department some tools, I'm all for, because it's hard enough to enforce as it is. So, yeah, absolutely. I'm ready to move forward. I think it's a good idea. And I think once people realize that we're serious, I think we might actually have less enforcement issues than we think once they realize it's for real. So those are my comments.
Okay. Thanks, Councilmember Costello.
And I, too, can support the three-pronged approach that's being suggested by staff here. I think it's appropriate. 10 o'clock is reasonable. Let's find the nuisance abatement provisions, beef them up, and let's work carefully with our fire department and manage the existing occupancy regulations such as they are.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem?
Yeah, I'll just say that when we got this complaint, I did go downtown and I checked it out, and it's been a long time since I've been up that late, for starters. But I will say I do think that probably the overcrowding is the issue. That was certainly what I saw. In fact, one of these places I couldn't possibly have gotten into. But I think what we're doing here is reasonable. The only thing I would add is that I do think, and this is from one of the seminars that I went to at the League of Cities, is that ultimately we're probably going to, either through the VIA or maybe indirectly through the Parking Association, we're going to have to get some sort of an education program where they talk to each other. And I know that the seminar I went to was in downtown San Jose, which granted is much, much bigger issue than we're talking about, or hopefully we'll ever be talking about. But I do think in the future we're going to see, you know, we have another bar planned, and maybe a few more that we're going to need. It isn't just us down there pounding on the doors. It's them working together to make sure that they are not becoming a nuisance as a group, let alone individually. So I'm certainly prepared to move forward with what you're here tonight and can support that.
Okay. Well, I concur with the Mayor Pro Tem and on the occupancy issue, and I really do believe that needs a good deal of attention in whatever effort we put forth there to develop some structure, better structure than we have now. The other thing that I would like to see is kind of related to, you know, the learning process, is that we probably should publish something that would constitute a guideline for compliance. In other words, if we're going to look at enforcement of occupancy, if we're going to look at enforcement of noise, here are some things that you can do to comply. Here are some things that you can do to stay within the boundaries of the new ordinance. So, and offer that well in advance of fielding this thing, so that people know what's coming and they know what's expected, and they also know what they can do to comply. So think about maybe doing something like that along with you know, the ordinance. Okay. I think we probably should have a motion on this. And staff is right. It's direction to staff, but it's also appropriating $2,500. So.
Mr. Mayor, I'd move that we direct staff prepare an ordinance that prohibits outdoor amplified noise after 10 p.m. and also amends the nuisance abatement procedures to provide the police department the increased authority that they need to address the complaints. Also additionally appropriate $2,500 for costs related to research and preparation of ordinance, as well as direct staff, police department, work with the fire department on the occupancy issues.
Okay, we have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
And a second. Further discussion? Hearing none, roll call, please.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnett?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. All right, so we're ready to move on to 11C, and this is consideration of an ordinance amending section 3.08.02, point E Edwards of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code regarding bidding thresholds. Good evening again, Teresa.
Good evening again, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. The Uniform Public Construction Cost Accounting Act provides uniform cost accounting standards and billing procedures for construction work performed or contracted by public agencies in the state. And in conformity of the act, allows projects of $45,000 or less that may be performed by city employees by negotiated contract or purchase order, and public projects of $175,000 or less to be let by contract by informal bidding procedures, and then public projects and exceeding that would be by formal bidding procedures. When the city originally adopted its ordinance quite some time ago governing the award of contracts for public projects, the monetary thresholds triggering informal and formal bidding requirements under the act were significantly lower. The cities incorporated those lower actual numbers, monetary thresholds, into section 3.08.020E of the Municipal Code. So in order to take advantage of the higher monetary threshold, staff is bringing forward the proposed ordinance with the higher monetary thresholds allowed by the act to be and included inside the ordinance. In addition, the language has been included in the ordinance that will automatically adjust these monetary limits contained in the ordinance whenever the California Uniform Construction Cost Accounting Commission promulgates such limits. So we won't have to continually come back to you and readjust our numbers. It will occur automatically. So essentially, this is just simply coming in conformance with the act and matching our limits with that, those limits allowed by the act. And that concludes my report.
All right. Any questions? I'm not seeing any questions. Anyone in the audience would like to contribute to this item with some observations? Seeing no one, we'll start to my right with Councilmember Costello.
Mr. Mayor, this just seems to be a cleanup issue for us, and I'll support this tonight.
Okay. Councilmember Brown?
As will I.
And Councilmember Barnett?
As will I.
As will I.
As will I.
I'll move an ordinance to City Council, City of Arroyo Grande, amending Section 3.08.020.E of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code regarding bidding thresholds under the Uniform Public Construction Cost Accounting Act.
Second.
All right. We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnett?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay, moving along. Item 12, council communication. Any council member have an item, announcement, observation?
I'd like to have an item probably put on the a discussion item put on a future agenda, and that is the issue of the housing element and HCD requirements to meet our housing, quotas that we've developed, because my understanding of that is different than what I think some other council members are. So I'd like to flesh that out during a public session.
The housing element update's actually on the September 9th agenda, so I assume we'll be covering those things at that time.
Perfect. That'll work. Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Good enough?
Yep.
All right.
Yeah, I have an item as well, and this is something I talked to Steve about earlier. We're going to have two fairly big events taking place here where they're going to cut up the road. One is the incident that the Phillips 66 is looking at, or is planning to put in a new pipeline, basically up Halcyon and then out Grand Avenue and Oak Park. I'd like to see us at least investigate the possibility of putting purple pipe in there in anticipation of you get a cost estimate in those. But I also wanted to add to that, and I think I didn't mention this here, I think the gas company is also doing something very similar. And if we could take a look at both of those projects and see what opportunities there would be for us to put purple pipe in advance, with the idea of being able to get access to some of the key areas. Just as an item we would bring back and review whether it's financially feasible.
Staff's already doing that when we look at those for both those projects, both purple pipe as well as the potential for fiber optics. There's some issues that come up with some of them as far as distance requirements between each pipe that can drive up the cost. So we're looking at that, but rather than us just making a determination that it might not be feasible or not, we'll get those costs and bring them to council so you have a chance to weigh in and present those to you for consideration before any decisions made.
Just for clarification, purple pipe is water?
Recycled water.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other announcements? The only thing I wanted to add was some kudos to Arroyo Grande and Bloom. If you enter the city on Valley, right by Los Barros, is one of our monument signs, and there were about 12 volunteers out there on Saturday morning, and that place was covered with weeds. It is now weed-free, and we spread, I think, 8 yards of bark on that entire corner, so it's looking much better than it did. So just want to put a shout out to our volunteers in the community. They're doing a terrific job. Okay, staff communications, anything, Steve?
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly update the council on where we're at with surplus water with the county, because the council had authorized, I think, one or two letters that we submitted to the county. It's going to be on their agenda next week. We believe we have not seen their staff report based on what we understand. They are going to come up with an alternate recommendation that would allocate what they're referring to as emergency water instead of surplus water, but in the same amount. We think in the same amount that we were trying to acquire. So conceptually, we have some concerns because it could modify how the allocation of state surplus water is determined in the future. We've given them some initial feedback that the proposal seems to meet our immediate needs, and therefore we'd likely be supportive if they give us some statement that this is not setting precedent moving forward, and that they're committed to sitting down with us and renegotiating the contract so moving forward we can specify all these things so that we have better agreement on how it's all going to be determined so we can do better water planning. So that's kind of just the initial feeling after all the jurisdictions met. We're waiting to see specifically, though, if that wording is going to be in there. But I wanted, since you've been weighing in terms of approving a couple letters that went to the board, I wanted to make sure to let you know where we're at and make sure there's no significant concerns with that direction at this time.
Can I make a comment on that? Just because I sit on the Zone 3 board, and what I think what the consensus was is that surplus water is a bad term. It makes it seem like we have all this extra water to waste, and it's basically our water that is allocated to Arroyo Grande that is unused from the prior water year. And so I know that we all agreed that something we shouldn't call it surplus water. But I was not, I'm not sure if that necessarily means that the contract would change as far as when we get it and if we don't get it. And so that might be a little bit different than our last Zone 3 meeting. It might have come up after that. I think we did talk about maybe looking at the contract, but I don't remember any significant changes, at least not at my last Zone 3 meeting.
No, it's the contract is what we're hoping to get a commitment from them to sit down with us and negotiate the contract. So these things are spelled out in the future.
Right.
So like I said, that's the our biggest concern right now. Throughout this past year, the county seems to be making a lot of unilateral decisions without involving them, involving us in them, or just disregarding the advisory board's recommendations and doing their whole thing. So that's the main point. We don't have such a problem with the recommendation, but we want a commitment from them that moving forward, we're going to work together and negotiate this thing, how we move forward. And if we can get that, then we feel, you know, we'll feel more comfortable.
Well, on the water issue, just a couple more quick comments. I don't know if you've heard from Rick Sweet or Shannon Sweeney. They were going to contact Jeff English on a kind of a unique concept for water recycling. And on that issue, and there are still a lot of facets spinning around in Sacramento in terms of what the water bond is ultimately going to look like, but but two common elements that I think are going to be fairly stable in there have to do, and there's about $1.2 to $1.5 billion programmed for it. This is the latest that I think the governor is trying to champion, but it's for groundwater basin maintenance and stability and water recycling. So those are two very important aspects to our water strategy here. And so it's all the more reason for us to continue to work towards having some good solid strategy and perhaps even getting to a point of a shovel-ready project, because if the bond passes, there's going to be money there that needs to be applied for quickly if we're going to have an opportunity to get some of those things put into our community.
We had some initial discussion on those particular ideas, and that is the push right now. And we obviously can't get into much discussion this evening because it's not on the agenda, but the next meeting, we'll be coming back with the public education and the water emergency ordinance recommendations at the next meeting. So we're going to have a number of things coming up here in the next few weeks that we're working on. It's really our primary focus right now.
Okay. All right, that takes us to item 14, and that's our final community comments and suggestions. And once again, Barbara or Gail, anything, whether it's on the agenda or not? Nothing? Okay, all right. Then we'll move to closed session. And we are about to adjourn to closed session, but before we do that, once again, invite the public to make any comment on the closed session item. And no takers on that. And I just wanted to indicate to you that even though the agenda says we will reconvene to open session, that will not happen here this evening. If there's any report out of closed session, that will be given out at the next regularly scheduled council meeting. All right, so at this time, the council will adjourn to closed session.